U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in Radical History for the week of November 17th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some audio is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And other radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
Proving yet again and breaking the myth that America was founded on religious freedoms, for on November 17, 1637, first American feminist Anna Hutchinson would stand trial for not following the Puritan model. During her trial, when it became obvious that the court would rule against her, she said these words in court, quote, "You have no power over my body, neither can you do me any harm. I fear none but the great Jehovah, which hath foretold me of these things, and I do verily believe he'll deliver me from your hands." She'd be called a heretic and an instrument of the devil. Quoting from the judges, "You have stepped out of your place. You have rather been a husband than a wife, a preacher than a hearer, a magistrate than a subject." Delayed in the term with her 15th child, she suffered greatly in jail and would suffer a miscarriage. More feminist news in 1866, anarchist feminist Valterini D. Claire is born in Leslie, Michigan. She'd teach in Philadelphia and would tour the world lecturing. She once said, "To me, any dependence, anything which destroys the complete selfhood of an individual, is in line of slavery." For her, equality and dignity for both sexes led her to her anarchist beliefs. Also on November 17, 1909, of course, Marines are invading once again, this time in Nicaragua, to protect American interests.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on November 17, 1942, hobo organizer, anarchist, and cultural dropout Ben Reitman dies. Dr. Ben Reitman crusaded, was beaten, tarred and feathered, jailed, and run out of town for his efforts on the behalf of the rights of women to control their own bodies, and his lifelong efforts to educate and improve the health of hobos. Also on this date in 1978, two FBI agents testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations that the Bureau's long-term investigation and surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was based solely on J. Edgar Hoover's, quote, "hatred of the civil rights leader," unquote, and the civil rights leader's alleged communist influences and linkage with radical groups. People, the time has come.
This is your radio news reporter, Citra Cacate. On this day, November 17th, in 1983, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, the EZLN, was founded in Chiapas, Mexico, by members of various rebel movements. The group of six men and women opposed the oppression and exploitation of indigenous peoples throughout the globalized world. When the EZLN appeared about 10 years later, in 1994, they had taken hold of five municipalities in Chiapas and declared war against the Mexican state. They have battled constant armed suppression from the Mexican military. However, they have also established an autonomous education and healthcare system, complete with its own schools, hospitals, and pharmacies, which are governed by a collectively established set of revolutionary laws. The Zapatista movement is a great example of collective revolution, and it is important that this kind of work is being done. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away. People, the time has
come. This is your radio news reporter, Citra Cacate. On this day, November 18th, in 1903, the Ibanao-Varilla Treaty was signed, giving the United States government exclusive rights to construct and manage the 10-mile-wide strip of the Panama Canal. The treaty was signed 2 weeks after Panama's independence from Colombia, which was backed by the U.S. after the Colombian government refused to cooperate with the Roosevelt administration. The negotiation is also known as the Treaty No Panamanian Sign because it was created and signed by the U.S. Secretary of State and a French engineer, Philippe Bonnet.
Canal Varilla. For 96 years, the U.S. retained rights over the canal, which was a constant source of conflict and violence between the people of Panama and the U.S. military.
Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for November 19th, 1493, Christopher Columbus, quote, discovers, unquote, Puerto Rico. And the Spaniards, once they are shown a gold nugget from the Puerto Rico River, decide that they will stay. They regularly would feed Indian infants to their dogs alive, and at times while the horror-stricken parents would watch. The Spaniards would also host contests to see who could cut through a living person in half with one stroke of their sword. They would test the sharpness of their blades by beheading the nearest handy native. A little reminder of next time you want to celebrate Christopher Columbus. Also on November 19, 1915, IWW labor organizer, folk poet Joe Hill murdered by firing squad in Utah. The subject of numerous songs, plays, and books. His last words to the labor organized supporters and friends of his was, "Don't mourn, organize." Here's a part of just one song of Joe Hill.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Lastly, for November 19, 2001, the Bush regime accuses Iraq and North Korea of developing germ warfare programs. Around the same time, Bush famously says in a speech that the United States never used weapons of mass destruction. I think the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki would not agree with him. On this day in Radical History for November 20, 1816, the term scab is used for the first time at Albany Typographic Society by author Jack London. To quote Jack London about scabs, "After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, the vampire, he had some awful substance left with which he made the scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew sole, a water-legged brain, a combination backbone of jelly and glue. When a scab comes down the street, men turn their backs, angels weep in heaven, and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep him out. Judas was a gentleman compared to a scab. For betraying his master, he had the character enough to hang himself. A scab has not." Jack London. Also on this date in 1856, U.S. Marines fight in the Battle of Canton Forts in China. Apparently, there's no place on Earth that the U.S. has not interest in to protect.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on this date, in 1892, in more labor news, hired thugs, gunmen, and state militia break the Homestead-Carnegie strike that began on the 1st. On this date in 1969, Indians from 20 tribes seize and occupy Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. American Indian Movement activists occupy the island for 19 months. They offer to pay $24 in glass and beads and red cloth for the land, the price paid by the whites for Manhattan Island. In a little bit of Wisconsin news, on November 20th, 1993, as Wisconsin deer hunters take to the woods and fields on opening day of gun hunting season, Alliance for Animal members protest at Devil's Lake State Park. They try to point out that this yearly ritual actually thins the deer herds of the healthiest and leaves the scrawniest and most sick behind, a kind of anti-evolutionary practice that actually weakens the herds, not strengthens them, for most hunters want the big bucks and will pass on anything that looks sickly. Now in Wisconsin, like many other places in the United States, chronic wasting disease is running rampant through the unhealthy herds and passing this brain disease onto hunters who kill and eat them. We should all understand fully now, with war and hunting practices, that though we have evolved enough to be able to make guns, we have not evolved enough to be wise about how to use guns. On a related subject, and showing how smart we really are, on November 20th in 2002, the National Geographic Survey found that 11% of all U.S. residents cannot find the United States on a world map, yet they can still have guns. On this day in radical history, for November 21st, I only have one item, 1897, Molly Stemmer is born. Anarchist and labor agitator, her militant activities got her deported from the United States in 1921 for distributing literature against the U.S. invasion of Russia. Then when they forced the Russia, she'd be deported from Russia 2 years later for distributing anarchist literature. Both lands showing true freedom. On this day in radical history, for November 22nd, New York female garment workers call for general strike, leading to the, quote, uprising of 20,000, unquote. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union strikes against sweatshop conditions, also called the Girls' Revolt, wins support from other workers and the women's suffragette movement in their persistence and unity in the face of police brutality and rigged courtrooms, as many of the picketers are beaten and fired. In the end, the garment workers would win a pay raise and work reduction to 52 hours a week. A great quote comes from a British journalist, atheist, and anarchist, Nicholas Walter, who was born on this date in 1934. He once wrote, "Many people say that government is necessary because some men cannot be trusted to look out for themselves. But anarchists say that government is harmful because no man can be trusted to look after anyone else. Amen, brother." Also on this date in 1936, over 500,000 attend the funeral of anarchist Durruti in Barcelona, who lost his life fighting against the fascists in Spain. Also on November 22, 1967, UN adopts Resolution 242 calling for Israel withdraw from the occupied territories. They still have not left Palestine, 41 years later. Though Iraq was in violation of 17 UN resolutions, Israel is in violation of 2.5 times as many, yet we don't invade Israel. Lastly, on this date in 1985, 143 surviving Kickapoo Indians on the Texas-Mexican border are given U.S. citizenship, ending a 140-year U.S. refusal to allow Kickapoo to live legally on their own lands. On this day in radical history, for November 23rd, we only have two items, 1903, Army troops dispatched to Cripple Creek, Colorado, to put down rebellion by coal-striking miners. Paid by miner owners and estate, General Sherman Bell and his men arrive and throw 600 Union workers into a military bullpen, holding them for weeks without charges. When a lawyer appears with a writ of habeas corpus, the general says, quote, "Habeas corpus, hell, we'll give them postmortems," unquote. Lastly, in 1981, acting President Ronald Reagan authorized the CIA to form paramilitary squads of Nicaraguan exiles to overthrow the government. This is the same clown who, on September 28, 1990, with a completely straight face, claims, quote, "We have never interfered in the eternal government of any country," unquote. And of course, from 1855 to 1981, there has been at least 40 military interventions in Mexico, South America, and the Caribbean alone.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. As long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more info. Special thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI New York, whose great audio I borrowed for the show. And more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more radical information. Comments or suggestions, please consider emailing me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. That's themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman said. If voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. This has been This Week in Radical History, and until next week, as always, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Joy, I voted."
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast that features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective that is largely missing in the news reporting and commentary brought to us through the Western media. This Week in Palestine brings you discussions of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The Palestinian voice we feature this week is that of Yasser Abu Jamai, director of the Gaza Mental Health Program. He is the successor to Dr. Iyad El Sarraj, who, until his untimely death, was a driving force and voice of the Gaza Mental Health Program, and who was featured often on This Week in Palestine. We spoke with Dr. Abu Jamai in an exclusive interview when he came to Boston on a speaking tour. Gaza, which has suffered many assaults by the Israeli military, is a traumatized population. No one in Gaza can escape the suffering brought on by the constant Israeli barrage, not even Dr. Jamai, who, in the latest assault named Protective Edge in the summer of 2014, lost 28 members of his family in a single bombing. Yet he and the staff of the Gaza Mental Health Program continue to serve the mental health needs of this traumatized society. Here is our interview with Dr. Yasser Abu Jamai. Dr. Yasser Abu Jamai, is that pronounced right? Mm-hmm. Jamai?
It's Abu Jamai with R, but it's...
Well, thank you for your willingness to speak with us on This Week in Palestine. You're touring several cities with Rand Goldstein of the Physicians for Human Rights Israel. You'll be in the Boston area for a few days. Tell us what your goals are. What are you trying to accomplish with the two of you speaking together on this tour in the United States?
The idea started initially a few months ago. We have the a youth organization called Rebuilding Alliance. And what they are trying to do is bring some people and speak on tours in the States. And actually the first time I spoke to them personally was during the war in 2014. Donna Baranski Walker called me to offer condolences because during that war, 28 members of my extended family died just in one single attack, and she was just calling to offer condolences. And then with time we started to speak each now and then. So one of the issues that came to my mind, like, you know, people are very well aware of the physical impact of the offensive or the last war. However, you know, when the war is over, those physical things stop. You know, no more people are killed and no more buildings are destroyed. But people continue to suffer. So no one really pays sometimes good attention to the psychological impact, to the mental health impact of the last offensive on the people. And that's why people keep following up the hot stories, you know. What is wrong happening here? What's wrong happening there? And then they are just forgetting about how people live. And this is very important to say that this is not the first time that we were, like, exposed to these attacks. We had the 2008 attack, and then the 2012, and now the 2014, and we keep feeling like we get people's attention just for a very short time during and immediately after the attack stops. But later on, no one really knows, and people start just forgetting, or their attention is shifting toward some other areas in the world. And, you know, now the world is full of hot stories. So part of it is just to come to speak to people, reminding them of the situation in Gaza Strip. Part of it is fundraising. Part of it is making new friends, you know, talking to people. And a very important part of it is to say, like me and Ran being together, that despite all of the difficulties that we both face in our work due to the occupation and the occupation violations of human rights, is that there is still hope, you know, and that even that the children in Gaza suffer and that adults also suffer, but there is still some hope in there, you know. And that all efforts should be put in building that hope and expanding it more and more, further and further, unless it's otherwise it will be too late for any peace in the region or any good solution to what's happening there at the moment.
Well, we certainly have followed with horror the assaults on the Gazan people by the Israeli military. And we're constantly aware that Gaza is a virtual prison under which the entire population is forced to live. In the past, we have spoken with your predecessor, Dr. Iyad Al-Sarraz, and have followed the work of the Gaza Mental Health Center, but many of our listeners are not familiar with your work, so I wonder if you would tell us about your practice at the Gaza Mental Health Center, and particularly the conditions under which you work.
Well, Yad Sarraj, he was working in the 80s in the only Gaza psychiatric hospital, and that was the only mental health facilities that would offer any kind of help and care to It was the only facility available for people in Gaza Strip, you know, the only mental health facility. And, you know, a psychiatric hospital is good for, like, psychiatric emergent cases and people who are in chronic illnesses that have, like, who have symptoms like severe aggression, suicidal ideation, attempts, etc., etc. But it's not a good place for someone who is living under, like, oppression and have some issues regarding how to cope with these violations, like patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, patients who are depressed. A psychiatric hospital is not the right place for them to receive treatment. And it was the second, the first intifada then started, and it was going on. And he thought that we should approach people in a different way, you know, and that we should start a community mental health center where you could treat people in the community, work with them in the community, and offer them not only psychiatric consultation, but also psychologists could be working, social workers could be working, and nurses could be working. And that was the idea, to just shift from the strict biological model that you give a medication and that's it, to a more like community-based psychosocial model. And over the years, that proved to be very successful. However, you know, the living conditions in the Gaza Strip continue to deteriorate and deteriorate because we had then, you know, like just 6 years of peace between 1994 and 2000. And later on, the second intifada erupted, and then the siege started in 2007. And after the siege, you know, 1, 2, and 3, large scale attacks on the Strip. So over the years, this situation continued to deteriorate. And the question is, how do you help people in these circumstances? Well, we started with one clinic in Gaza City, but today we have 3 clinics, one in Gaza City, the other one in Deir el-Balah, in the middle areas of Gaza Strip, and the third one is in Khan Yunis in the south. So through these 3 community centers, and by the way, we have more than 70 professionals who work on full-time. 70 people who work for us on full-time basis, and we have other people who come on short contracts, you know, like another like 20 to 30 people who are just on short contracts. So what we try to do is, first we offer services, specialized mental health care to you know, to men and women, males, females, and also to children and adults. We are almost the only one mental health, specialized mental health care provider who offers, that offers mental health care to children. So we have the facility and we have the skills to offer care to the children. In addition to that, you know, we were like a good model for people to see and learn from. So, like in the early 90s, we proved to be very effective, and people who were visiting, you know, people who were visiting from the States, from Europe, to give us some training, more capacity building, and more skills, they were too much happy with the work we were doing, and they thought that it's a good idea to start disseminating these skills and knowledge. So we started various capacity building programs within GCMHP. And we started a diploma in community mental health in the year 1997. That diploma, like, you have the intake on an annual basis of something like 15 professionals, 15 to 20 professionals, who are graduates of medicine, psychology, sociology, and nursing. And together you spend 1 year teaching them in a theoretical program, and then for the second year, you just put them into our, like, residency program in our community centers.
And so you have your own training program.
We have our own training program. It's academically accredited postgraduate diploma, high diploma in community mental health, and it's the academic accreditation comes from the Islamic University. So that's how we cooperate with the university regarding the certification.
The certificate.
And so far we have more than 180 graduates. Most of them work like in school counselors, like in schools as counselors, and some primary health care units and other health facilities. So one way or the other, although we have limited amount of professionals, but one way or the other we try to add more human resources in this field, in this area, through training others on how to become capable of providing services to people. And when we speak about offering services, it's not only the therapeutic services. Another service is the free telephone counseling unit. So people who are like skeptic about coming to Gaza Community Mental Health Clinics, you know, stigma is all the time there.
Yes.
It keeps a challenge. It's a challenge all the time to mental health practitioners in all the world. But in that, we have some good news, because when we started in 1990, you know, we had zero referrals, self-referrals. So most of the referrals, all of them were coming from mental health, I mean physicians and from health practitioners. However, this year we have something like 70% of our clients, our patients, are self-referred or family-referred, which means that we have done a great job in working with the stigma. Now, going back to the free telephone counseling unit, we thought that this is a good idea or a good way of allowing, you know, women and adolescents to approach us. And give more chance to marginalized people to talk to us if they cannot come to the clinic. And it's going also very well. At the moment, we have like 65% of our clients are women, which is good. So we all the time, this is a good example of like, we all the time keep gender issues in our mind, you know, and we try to approach all the people, no matter, you know, in accordance with their needs. It's very important to say also that we also offer training programs to our CBOs, community-based organizations. So you have many community-based organizations across Gaza Strips. There are hundreds of them. And they work in small communities, in small neighborhoods. So what we do is that, like, we try to arrange various training courses to those people, because you need to increase awareness about mental health issues. And I'll give you one example. You know, if a child, you know, his school achievement started to decrease, or for example, he started to become like aggressive, then his parents will think that something is wrong with that child. Yeah. But they wouldn't think that it's a trauma or that he's afraid. They would think that this child is becoming like misbehaving, you know, he's like becoming more disobedient. While actually, in many of the cases, you just need to sit with the child and ask him to speak about, you know, his fears, you know, try to talk to him more, spend some more time with him.
Get to the root of the anger and the root of the problem, yeah,
and then solve it, and then that child will be able to continue a good education, you know, and then you are like changing the whole life of a child is changing the whole life of a future family, you know. So you need to go and talk to the people, you know, offer them some guidance that sometimes, you know. If a child was great in his first class at school, if he's in the second grade, he's not doing well, it doesn't mean that he suddenly became like, you know, having problems. But you should think of some mental health issues and concerns. And that's why we talk to public in public, you know, we call to people and we talk to people in their neighborhoods. Sometimes we use the radio programs. Sometimes we go to the TV, we participate in TV shows, just bringing as much attention as possible to these issues. What really is challenging is that the conditions in Gaza are not improving. You know, the siege continues now since the year 2007. Parts of the siege like started to get like easier, like all food items can now get into Gaza, because for example, for a certain time, pasta was not even allowed to get into Gaza.
Food is getting in.
So food is getting in. You can import food, no problem with medication, generally speaking. But the major problem now is with reconstruction material.
Right.
So during the attack, you know, OCHA reports speak about 18,000 residences that were fully destroyed, another 40,000 residences that were partially destroyed. And people are waiting for the reconstruction material to get into Gaza. And the first 1,000 unit, the announcement that it's going to start rebuilding the first 1,000 unit was just last June, almost 10 months after.
Yes, because I read that even though the international community had pledged quite a bit of money following the assault in 2014, reconstruction was just not happening. And was it because, I mean, the money seemed to be there. Was it because Israel will not allow the building materials to come through the checkpoints. Is it the problem getting the materials in, or is the international community, not giving the money it pledged to? What seems to be the problem in getting construction materials into Gaza?
Well, the first thing is that Israel wanted to make 100% sure that this is the argument, the Israeli argument is that they want to make sure that the reconstruction material won't get into the wrong hands.
I see.
That's what they say. Mm-hmm. And so they were raising many security issues and concerns, and, all the time the only way for Gazans to receive goods, is through Israel. There is no other way, basically.
Right. The tunnel economy is gone now.
Well, yeah, the tunnel is gone. Of course, it ended since even before the last attack. So the what they were saying is that we want to ensure that this will not reach the wrong hands, and they had to reach an agreement with the international community and with the Palestinian Authority on how to allow reconstruction material getting into Gaza without, making sure that the thing is not going to reach, the wrong people, or Hamas, or those. And they came out. The result of all of this was a very poor and slow reconstruction mechanism. And that's because, it's a lengthy process. It takes a lot of time. So each one who is going to build a house or to rebuild his house has to report his, location, submit the plan, the design, everything. They will count the material needed, and they will send you like one third of it, and then they will make sure that you use the one third of it. Then you apply, you get the second third of it. And then they come, they inspect, and then they come and check that everything is fine, and then they give you the third part of it. And this has to apply to each one who applies for a reconstruction material. And the other part of it, second part of it, is that the Israelis are not allowing enough trucks to pass into Gaza. So there is still limitation on the accessibility of this reconstruction material to Gaza. And the third part of it, which is some of the pledged money is not coming. Some of the pledged money is not coming. So it's a complicated issue. But I would say that, in basically speaking, this is not helping people. And people continue to suffer. More than 100,000 people lost their houses.
And the reconstruction is going family by family, not sort of block by block or area by area.
No,
so
no.
It's one family at a time that applies. If accepted, gets a third of the money, a third of the money, etc. So this is a long process.
The 18,000 residences were present across the whole Gaza Strip, And sometimes they take, You feel like if you have in this neighborhood 50 houses were destroyed, like two of them got lucky this time, and people continue to wait, and I'm not sure really how they pick or which ones that they pick, but I think I'm not sure how that thing happens, but again the first 1,000 units started just June, and let's assume that that was 10 months after the ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And what about the other 17,000 residences, And this is just the beginning of the reconstruction of the fully destroyed houses. So those 100,000 people, you don't find any homeless person in the streets of Gaza. You went there more than once. You don't ever see homeless people in Gaza. So they go to stay with their relatives. So these 100,000 people are impacting other people. And all of the people in Gaza Strip are living under siege. So living in, living out, visiting others, trying to travel abroad is not allowed. Some of the material is not allowed to get into Gaza, and it's just like, for example, engines for the fishermen are not allowed to get into Gaza. This is a very strange thing. What does a fisherman...
Engines for their boats?
For their boats, yeah, for the ships, for the boats. And, you know, we have small ships that, because we are not allowed to go fishing that deep in the sea. You know, we have like a three... I don't know how they call it, 3 miles, you know, that and that's it. And another story of it, or another part of it, is that there is an international report came recently, speaks about Gaza, and it fully describes how the situation in Gaza Strip, and it says simply that by the year 2020, Gaza will not be a good or inhabitable place anymore. You know, they speak about 90% of the people do not have access to safe drinking water. More than 70% of the people are totally dependent on international aid. You know, more than 45% of the people are unemployed. And when you look at the age 25, 20, 35, then it goes higher than 65%. And people continue to be desperate, you know. And there is no real development on the ground. What's happening is like a systematic de-development. And when you add on top of that the lack of electricity, you know, you get power something like 8 hours a day. And that's what you have.
So the problem of infrastructure is not being addressed. That is the water, the sewage, electricity. Are you saying that's not being addressed? That rebuilding is not going on, or
I couldn't say that it's addressed if the siege is going now for 7 years, you know, and if I still do not find good drinking water in Gaza Strip, you know. So whatever happens, there are many people who are trying to help one way or the other, but everything is going in a very slow motion, you know, as if the aim is not to allow people to grow. I'll put it in another words. Let's assume that there is, you know, like we are a free country. Let's assume that Gaza is free. It has its own like government, and we have no problem. Usually, you should keep up with the people increase in population, you know. So you need to improve, and you need to have more resources, more capacity, more like electrical power coming in, more water resources. But what happens in Gaza, it's not only that we have now almost 2 million people in there, which is like double what we had 15 years ago, but the problem is that the available resources are also decreasing because of the ongoing siege. So this is heavily causing the development of various sectors in Gaza Strip. And it touched the health sector in a very dramatic way, because part of it is that, you know, medical practitioners, you know, are not giving the chance to train abroad, you know. They are sometimes blocked from traveling. If there is an international conference you need to attend, sometimes you do not get the permit to that, because this is considered it's not a very important issue. Patients who are in Gaza Strip, you know, any patient in Gaza Strip who does not have the possibility to receive therapy in Gaza is offered by the PA. You know, the PA should cover his cost or her cost to travel abroad and receive treatment. And traveling abroad means Gaza, Egypt, West Bank, or Israel. Now, many of those people who apply do not get the permission.
Just can't get out.
Yeah, 20% of the people who apply to travel for health, they do not, in Israel, to go to Israel to receive help, they are not getting that permit.
20%?
20%, yeah. And Ran was saying that more than 200,000 people apply on annual basis to receive permit, to receive medication or to travel for medication. If you calculate 20% of them, that leaves you with something like 40,000 people. And the other problem of it, like, sometimes if you do not have a life-saving, if you do not need a life-saving intervention, then this is not an emergency. So you cannot be referred immediately. You know, you need to wait for the application. you need to get the cost covered from the PA, and then you need to apply, and then you need to wait until that application is approved and you are receiving the permit. Another part of the story is the destruction that took place to some of the primary health care units, some of the hospitals during the offensive. So it's not only lacking personnel, it's not only like lacking trained people, but it's sometimes not only lacking the equipment, but sometimes even some of the buildings are partially destroyed because it was targeted during the attacks. The main rehabilitation building, the main rehabilitation hospital that we had in Gaza Strip, Al-Wafa Hospital, was completely demolished during the war. And now, you know, you don't have that proper rehabilitation facility in the Strip.
In terms of education, the Palestinian people, historically among the most educated people, I'm wondering what's happening in terms of educating not only the children in Gaza, but also the ability of students to study at the university level, what's available in Gaza, and what problems do they face trying to leave Gaza, to go to medical school, to go to law school, engineering school, whatever. How does that impacting on the Gazan population and sort of the future of education?
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't have that many resources in Gaza. And for Palestinian people, you know, we all think that the best investment that you could make is like to invest in your children's education. So then your child will have the chance, the possibility maybe to earn a job and to make a life in the future. That's why all Palestinian people, they stress on their children. And they try to empower their children, and they are like, we are like Kofpushi, you know. We need our children to get the higher marks, not only to pass the grades. And that's why many of the children who has, you know, whose grades start to decrease, they just, their parents start to dig, what's the problem, you know, and they come to us in order to help them, to help their children overcome the challenges they face. But when it comes to university education, you know, we had something like two main universities in Gaza before the PA started, and now we have like five or six universities who offer a variety of faculties, including now we have medical faculty of medicine. But the problem is that first, the quality of education is a big question, because, you know, there is serious development that takes place in all aspects of science, you know.
Yes.
And if you are not up to date with these things, you know, what's the benefit of training people on old methodologies, for example? And if you go to a hospital, you find physicians applying something that was, or using medications that used to be used in the 80s and 90s, while you are now in 2015. So you need to keep up with the development and updates, and that doesn't really take much place. The other part of it is that for postgraduate education, okay, we have two schools of medicine, but we don't have higher education, like for masters, for PhDs, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to physicians. Now, that is lacking. And, you know, sometimes you can apply for international universities, and sometimes you get a seat in there, but it becomes a big challenge how you are going to travel abroad.
Yeah, we constantly hear stories about people getting into universities, even getting scholarships, etc., yeah. but then yeah. not able to get out,
yeah.
and the fear that if they get out, they won't be able to get back in.
Yeah. Well, that question was a very big one, and for many years this continued to be a remarkable problem, and as part of the siege and blockade. Now, recently there is some improvement, you know, like the Ministry of Civil Affairs, the Palestinian Ministry of Civil Affairs, tried one way or the other to keep in communication with the Israeli government and allow some of the students to leave. And this happens now It happens every now and then. But again, this is not like a solution to the story, you know. The solution is very simple. The international law gives everyone the chance to leave once, you know, if you have a visa, if you have a scholarship, then it's your right to travel and go to that country, the country that offered you a place and the stay and the visa, you know. So what's happening now is against the international law. Everyone knows this. And the very simple solution is just to allow people travel and lift the blockade. Just lift the blockade, yeah. Yeah. Allow the borders to work like any other places in the world. I was in while traveling, I would say, sometimes you tell people, you know, well, it might be difficult to get back, and you need like a permit and the coordination to get back on a very specific day. And they say, what? You need a permission to go where? I say, to Gaza. But you will be going back home. Well, still you need a permit. And this is the fact, you know. If I'm going back in Gaza on like 10th or 11th, then I should say the specific date, and I should tell them like 1 week at least in advance, and they will make sure that I get the permit to go back to Gaza on that day. If you left through, for example, Rafah borders, through Egypt, then you cannot go back through Jordan, for example, you know. Like, you need to be, your chances are extremely limited. And the possibilities to plan, to think about the future when it comes to travel, is almost not there. So, also what really impacts the health system is that some of the brilliant physicians who work in Gaza, you know, these were some of them, like graduates of U.S. Universities, of English universities, of German universities, they are really brilliant. They kind of, some of them lost hope and just started to find some other places to go to. And this is, again, heavily impacting the health system in Gaza, because if the brilliant ones are also leaving, then what's going to be like in 2 or 3 years? If one hospital is impacted, you know, during the attack, then you are left with lesser hospitals that could serve the people, you know. And that's how the things continue to take place.
The United Nations has had responsibility for educating a lot of the children in Gaza. Are they still heavily involved in the schools? Are the schools open and adequate?
70% of the people who live in Gaza Strip are refugees. Among those, you know, 52% of all the population in Gaza Strip are children. So now we are speaking about something like 900,000 children who live in Gaza Strip.
900,000
yes.
Children.
Most of them are in school age and they need education. The UNRWA is currently still operating schools for refugees from the first grade until the ninth grade. When it comes to the 10th, 11th, and 12th grades, these are only for the Ministry of Education. And I think more than 250,000 children, they receive education at the UNRWA schools. One of the problems that face the UNRWA, it's like, again, like the Palestinian Authority, you know, we keep all the time hearing about shortages of support. And here we come, we talk about financial support. So you are deprived of your rights, you are living under education and occupation, and sometimes there is a big chance that your children lose the possibility to receive good education. And this keeps happening every now and then. And I think UNRWA was just facing some difficulties in raising funds for the education system. They all the time are under budgeted. And we had a big issue, like, I think, a couple of months ago. The UNRWA said that it might either need to delay the beginning of the schooling year or simply has to fire some of the school teachers because of the lack of funds. You know,
funding resources. through the United Nations. You have increasing problems in Gaza and less and less money coming through the United Nations.
It's less and less money coming to the PA, less and less money coming to the United Nations, and less money coming to any place. I think it's That's why we think that Gaza is forgotten, you know. Mm. Less money is coming in because more money goes to the other places. And you need to keep raising this issue, you know. Yeah. If you were exposed to a devastating war, then when it's over, it's not over, actually. It keeps many things in people's minds. And when you do not allow people to reconstruct and rebuild their destroyed houses, then it becomes a totally different story. If you don't allow reconstruction material to get into the people neighborhoods, then nothing is going to change. If people continue to walk among the rubble, you know.
Yes.
There are many efforts in rubble removal that took place. But still, now we are like 14 months after the ceasefire, still, rubble is still in Gaza in many places, and that rubble is polluted. You know, explosive material is explosive material. No matter what's in there, it's still polluted.
Toxic.
It's toxic. Basically, it's toxic, and people just breathe there, they walk through there. And the ironic thing about this is that now we are having the second winter after the war.
Right.
And, you know, this water, the rains, is going to wash these toxins and send them down to the ground. And you know what's in the ground?
Pollute the water.
They will pollute the water. And the ironic thing is that it's not only us who drink from that water.
Yeah.
It's Palestinians and Israelis who drink from that water. And I wouldn't think that any clever politician will really attack a land that will end up polluting his water, you know, and the water for his own people. But unfortunately, how politics sometimes work. And our sewage is dumped into the seawater sometimes because we do not have the resources and the possibilities of purifying it.
So it's polluting the Israeli beaches,
and,
right?
And yes, the Israeli,
they talk about their beaches.
Yes, and they are swimming in that pollution. So it's really ironic, and I do not find means of understanding why we keep, I mean, the Israelis keep thinking of that the military solution is the right one. While there is the other very basic thing, the simple one, which is just give people their freedom. That's it.
Yeah, right.
It's very simple.
They're fouling their own nest and creating enormous problems for themselves, and they don't have the long view, that's for sure. Well, how can we in the United States, how can we help the Gaza Mental Health Center? I know there's a foundation here, the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. It's a tax-deductible organization.
Yeah.
And we can contribute there. What else do the American people need to do to help?
Well, I'll tell you many things. Like, first of all, like people who could donate through organizations like the Gaza Mental Health Foundation make a big difference. For example, during the previous years, we used to give medications free of charge to people. And this used to cost something like $90,000 to $100,000 a year. Last year, due to the increased need after the offensive, that money grew to $125,000. And, of course, we are a non-governmental organization, non-profit organizations, and we are completely independent. Independent, we just work for the sake of helping people. That's how Iyad al-Sarraj established us, and that's how we continue to be. So we rely basically on donations that come from generous governments and generous people. So this is an important part of it, and there are many important other areas of it. Like, for example, if people can come to Gaza, they would not only show solidarity, but they will also be able to offer training to the people who are there. And it doesn't matter, you know, you can come as a mental health practitioner, as a psychiatrist, you could come and offer some training. You can also come as a psychologist and offer some training. If you think that you are not good at training, or training is not your, like, you are not fan, you know, it's, some people, they don't just like to sit in lectures and give lecturing, then you just come and hear the stories. You just offer us then a sort of care for caregivers. Because one of the issues that we all the time think about is secondary traumatization, you know. We were living in Gaza. Well, for 51 days, those 50,000 shells who were falling in Gaza, we were there, basically. We were hearing the loud explosions every now and then. Some of us lost his beloved people. I lost many of my family, extended family members. There are many others who lost people and lost property. So And we keep hearing the bad stories coming from the people who lost their houses and their beloved ones. So we are at extreme risk of developing secondary traumatizations and becoming traumatized ourselves.
Yeah.
So when some people come and offer just to hear us, to listen to us, and offer sort of care, that is also important. And again, some of the people who are into education, they are more than welcome to come, help us train the high diploma students, you know, help give guidance to people who come and receive training from the CBOs. And there are many other creative ways, you know. People think in a creative way, like Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. They just organize a trip on an annual basis to Gaza. They bring like 15 to 20 professionals. They come from various disciplines, including surgeons, including cardiologists. And they offer a wide spectrum training, you know, to many people. And we help them work with other institutions. So think creatively, you know. We say in Gaza that we still hope that there is a chance, and we work into expanding that hope in people's hearts and people's, you know, minds. So if we are not losing hope, you also should not lose hope, and you should be more creative than us. And I'm sure that you will not, you will all the time find different means of helping people in Gaza. We are organizing an international conference in Gaza, and that international conference is going to take place in the coming April. The announcement is made, it's on our website. Our website is www.gcmhp.net, and people who are interested to go to Gaza to submit abstracts to go to that conference, please go ahead and just contact the coordinator, the conference coordinator.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, Yasser, we've reached the end of our time, unfortunately. Thank you for speaking with us, and thank you for the work you do, and we hope that we will see you in Gaza.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was an interview with Dr. Yasser Abu Jamai, director of the Gaza Mental Health Program. You can support this important work and keep in touch with the Gaza Mental Health Program through the website of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Just Google Gaza Mental Health Foundation, a local tax-deductible foundation, to stay in touch. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org, or listen to us anytime via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., click on Listen, and you will hear the program. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts at any time, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning. طفلة تمتطي قوس
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black.
Becker writes that humans cause evil by wanting to triumph over evil in the quest for immortality.
Our most depressive and violent and brutal behaviors, Becker says, are responses to our death anxiety.
The core problem is that we've got to invest in these worldviews, and then we've got to defend them. And in defending him, we often end up hurting others.
The most brutal and primitive style of coping with death is to dream that you can master it by killing or destroying other people.
We commit the greatest evil by trying to escape from evil, by trying to create a paradise on earth.
We are literally looking for things to label evil, so that once we've done that, we can fight them.
Today, our nation saw evil.
We will not rest until this evil is driven from our world.
And I will not allow the people of this country to be intimidated by evil cowards.
We demonize folks. We see them as the all-encompassing repositories of evil, the removal of which would make life on earth as it is in heaven.
So more people have been killed in the name of God and country than by all the serial murderers put together. It's just a drop in the bucket compared to how much killing has gone on out of loyalty, patriotism, love for God and country.
You're listening to episode 726 of Unwelcome Guests, The Flight from Death. I'm Robin Upton. Exceptionally this week, we begin with a dedication. This show is dedicated to Lily Pierce, a young woman whom I never met, but without whose tragic death on the roads, I would not have made this show. In 2013, an Unwelcome Guests listener, David Pierce, recommended a book to me that he had been recommended after his daughter's tragic death, Ernest Becker's Denial of Death, and at the time, perhaps due to my mother's cancer, I wasn't very assiduous in seeking a PDF or an audiobook, and I let the matter slip. Well, I've now followed the matter up and am very glad that I did so, because I think that book is nothing less than a masterpiece. I can quite understand why the academic establishment didn't really want to have much to do with it at the time. Not helped, of course, Ernest Becker, labelled a cultural anthropologist for the sake of having a label on him, took a very cross-disciplinary and, I think, commendably honest approach, seeking wisdom from all quarters, which he brought to bear on the central topic of the fear of death. His main contention being, while our own mortality and fear of death is not much talked about, it is nevertheless an extremely important topic, much thought about and psychologically repressed. Now, if that sounds slightly wishy-washy, hand-wavy, well then I haven't done the man justice. His book is tightly argued, well-referenced, and cites a lot of other great thinkers from different academic disciplines, principally psychology, also philosophy, cultural anthropology, literature, a wide range. As an introduction to Becker's thought, I've found a 90-minute film, The Flight from Death, which I'm going to be adapting for this show. I thought, let's begin with the voice of David Pearce. This is from an interview in 2012. The full interview is linked from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/726. We're just going to hear one short question, and this is from the Future Primitive podcast.
Please talk about a practical way in which a person who is not in grief can communicate and be helpful to someone who has had a great grief.
That's a fine question, because it's most difficult for those who have not experienced some sort of a deep disconnection with everything that they knew before to really relate to this, because we are all sort of trained unconsciously from the time we're small children to act and think a certain way in Western culture. And it's different in some of the other countries and cultures. Norway is in some ways a lot more open to the ideas of grieving and recognizes that. Villages in Africa and in South America, some of the Latin countries, the Central American countries, and Spain, Italy, they're a bit more open to everyone being sort of aware that people die and grieve. In the United States, not so much. Death is often talked about. Movies, horror films, jokes about death and that kind of thing, but never really seriously. In fact, later on, after Lily died, I realized that those are a way of sort of talking about death, but avoiding the subject, finding ways to keep it in their minds, but sort of diminish it somehow as a way of kind of triumphing over it without really having to face it. So it's most difficult for people who have not experienced deep grief to relate on the same wavelength. People may think, you know, that they're really sad for the person who has lost a loved one or a friend, and they may genuinely feel sorry for them and want to help, but oftentimes they don't really know where to go.
Now, the longer in the tooth that I get, the more I come to see in Gatto's admonition that the inevitability of death must be an important part of curriculum of what young people learn to become properly educated. And it's one that circumstances taught me. Perhaps that's why I seem to understand this. In any case, I would encourage you, even if you live in a country such as the United States and here in Bangladesh, when I discuss the way in which old people tend to be sent to homes surrounded by people of the same vintage, more or less as a kind of warehousing. The general understanding is that this is a pretty barbaric way to deal with one's nearest and dearest, and I must say I tend to agree. Now, just before we hear the film, I think I should point out the main two echoes of Unwelcome Guests' themes that it set off in my mind. Number one, you may not be surprised to hear, is money, how money is a proxy for immortality. They would call it an immortality symbol, something that people can use to quell their fear of death, never mind the fact that it won't work, as they will explain in the film. This fulfills a psychologically calming function. And the second echo is the war on terror, as we heard in episode 721. Those who organize false flags are not just looking at numbers of fatalities, they're also looking to communicate meaning and to instill fear. Well, I can't believe the importance of Becker's work has been lost on those who've spent so long in all those think tanks researching how to make people afraid. Now, this is a radio adaptation of a film which has been posted on YouTube, so if you'd like to watch the film itself and have internet access, then I shall link to the original from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/726.
To have emerged from nothing, to have a name, consciousness of self, deep inner feelings, an excruciating inner yearning for life and self-expression. And with all this, yet to die.
Transcendental Media presents a film by Patrick Shen and Greg Benick, narrated by Gabrielle Byrne. Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality.
Humankind has always been restless. Never satisfied with our physical limitations, we have always strived for more. With machines, we conquer gravity and travel faster and farther than any other animal. We explore the heavens, the last great frontier.
Landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
And we manipulate our own biology through medical science. In defiance of nature, we have manufactured the means to become rulers of the natural world. What is left to conquer? And are we satisfied? Since time immemorial, we have battled our greatest limitation, one which seems to render our efforts to overcome and conquer insignificant. Every day we participate in a multitude of activities to distance ourselves from harm and death. But beneath the surface, we are aware that these day-to-day strategies are doomed to fail. We will die eventually. And all of this will come to an end. Human beings find themselves in quite the predicament. We have the mental capacity to ponder the infinite, seemingly capable of anything, yet housed in a heart-pumping, breath-gasping, decaying body. We are godly, yet creaturely. Death is the end of the self. It is perhaps the ultimate mystery. We may never know what death really is, and whether it marks the end of everything, or, as many believe, the beginning of something else. Yet we do know that death is something to be avoided. What are we to do with death, and why do we fear it?
Merlin Mowry, Professor of Philosophy and Religion.
If we don't even know what death is, then why should we fear it?
Ervin D. Yalom, existential psychotherapist.
The fear of death is
absolutely ubiquitous. It's hardwired into us.
For all the things that we don't know about what follows death, there are plenty of things we know about what precedes death to make it unwelcome and even seem like an evil interruption, and that is life itself.
Sam Keen, author and philosopher.
At the gut level, my feeling is death is unacceptable. I did not sign that contract. I looked at the small print and everything else. It's unacceptable. That's just sort of a gut feeling in the sense that we love life. Death is an insult to our spirit. Added to that, of course, is the fear of the process of dying, which is different, of the indignity of it, of the loss of control, of the pain associated with it.
Others will say what they fear is leaving everyone behind, or they fear that the sadness they will cause others.
August of 1999, my life was forever changed because I was given a diagnosis of infiltrating ductal carcinoma, which, as medical people know, is a very common form of breast cancer. I have gone into an advanced state of breast cancer with metastatic disease to the bone, and I'm basically in the battle for my life right now. I don't know what tomorrow may bring. The average prognosis for a person with metastatic bone disease is 2 to 5 years. I'm now in year 3, so according to medical statistics, I probably only have 2 years to live.
We have capacities to think symbolically, to make one thing stand for another, which of course is the basis of language. We have the capacity to project ourselves in time and imagine things that have not yet happened. We have the capacity to think in terms of cause and effect. We have the capacity to reflect back on ourselves and look at ourselves from a perspective outside of ourselves. All of these capacities play a central role in the system through which humans regulate their behavior.
Sheldon Solomon, professor of psychology, Skidmore College.
On the one hand, we have these minds that are capable of just really embracing the entire universe on all fronts. You know, we can think of the old days, we can think of 5 million years from now, we can think about what it would be like to be tap dancing on the Great Wall of China while we stand here by the Golden Gate Bridge. So we can ponder our present circumstances in light of future possibilities and modify our behavior accordingly. All of that is tremendous, and all of it is highly problematic because it renders us as human beings uniquely aware of the inevitability of our demise.
Dan Lichty, professor of social work, Illinois State University.
We then recognize that death happens to us. I have to live with the knowledge that I will die. All organisms have a life instinct, an instinct to live. Our species has as much of that as any other species, but we also have the intelligence to know that we're doomed.
Our survival presents a problem for us because we have the kind of consciousness that makes us aware from a pretty early point in life that desire to live, to feed and live and survive, is ultimately going to fail.
That creates a cognitive problem for us. It creates a potentially enormous amount of anxiety that we have to do something with.
The explicit awareness that you're a breathing piece of defecating meat, destined to die and ultimately no more significant than, let's say, a lizard or a potato, is not especially uplifting.
Fear is a response to danger. Animals experience fear, but animals live in the present moment. When animals experience fear, they're experiencing a present danger which is either a predator or a fire or some threat to their life, and their response to that is the fight-flight reaction. They either fight the predator or flee from the predator. We also experience fear when we're confronted by a present danger. We can anticipate future dangers, and we can imagine future dangers, but the physiology is the same, fight-flight reaction, because the body can't tell the difference between the past and the future. Anxiety is the anticipation or imagination of a future danger. So we're all anxious about the future because we know we're going to die. We just don't know when.
We carry a burden of anxiety that no other species carries.
And one day, the heart just quits. Yes, he looked healthy.
Since the beginning of recorded history, and likely long before that, the awareness of our own mortality has haunted us. We've gone to great lengths to forget, deny, and overcome death. From the ancient myth of Osiris to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, history is rich with tales of the afterlife and of men and women, kings and pharaohs, rising from their graves and returning from the dead. In 1839, archaeologists discovered in a region that includes parts of modern-day Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, one of the oldest known and most profound literary works. Inscribed on a series of tablets which date back as early as 2000 BCE, we find the Epic of Gilgamesh, the story of an ancient Sumerian king who, inspired by the death of a close friend, embarks on a journey to find the secret of immortality. A Chinese proverb instructs, treat death as life. In ancient China, Emperor Qin Shi Huangdi spent his life hoping to avoid death. He commissioned doctors to concoct potions and sent ships out to sea in search of islands where immortals supposedly lived. Fearful that his efforts might ultimately fail, he enlisted more than 500,000 conscripts to build a magnificent underground tomb surrounded by over 7,000 life-sized terracotta soldiers in military formation. Upon the emperor's death, living servants were also buried with him. In every corner of the world, myths of immortality and the means to achieve it have been at the heart of people's most cherished beliefs. From magical elixirs to elaborate tombs furnished with spectacular treasures, there was no limit to humankind's imagination, and no possibility left unexplored. So how are things different today? While many of these antiquated methods still exist in some form or another, our technologies are advancing exponentially by the year. Yet, our death anxiety is still as present as ever. In our efforts to combat death and the aging process, scientists have now developed the means to reverse certain aspects of aging, while others claim to be on the verge of solving the problem of death altogether. Despite our technologies and desire for miracle cures, the reality of death has not changed. Infectious and parasitic disease will claim the lives of approximately 18 million people this year. Heart disease and other circulatory diseases will kill 16 million. Another 5 million will die in traffic accidents. In total, 54 million people alive this very moment will be dead in the next 12 months.
Anxiety pervades every bit of our human experience. In part, we respond to that anxiety by trying to feed ourselves in literal ways and secure our safety and survival in literal ways. But knowing that's ultimately doomed, we use our consciousness, our cleverness, our intellectual abilities to redefine the problem.
Cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker
spent his career investigating the human problem of death awareness. Awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1974, The Denial of Death is a culmination of his life's work, a synthesis of the wisdom of the ages. Once referred to as one of the few great books ever written, The Denial of Death formulates what has been considered to be a science of humankind, a broad theory that attempts to explain why we do the things we do.
Ernest Becker appeared out of nowhere.
Jeff Greenberg, professor of psychology, University of Arizona.
Ernest Becker, fairly early in his career, developed a sense that what he wanted to do was sort of bring together a lot of the knowledge that was being accumulated in the different social sciences and even outside, even the humanities as well.
That led him into an exploration of the writings of the ages.
He said, I want to understand very broad questions about what it is that underlies human behavior. And Becker's position was, if you take that quest seriously, then you can't confine your inquiry to any particular discipline. He said that big questions require wide-ranging scrutiny, and that no discipline should be disqualified from active consideration. What he insists is that the human species solved the existential problem of death by utilizing the same intellectual skills that, in an odd way, created the problem in the first place, and that's our vast intelligence and ability to think in abstract and symbolic ways in the service of constructing and maintaining what he calls culture.
For Becker, culture is a collective fabrication, a shared set of beliefs about the nature of reality, developed to help us deal with our death anxiety. Culture provides meaning and helps us to maintain a sense of security in an unsure world.
Professor Robert J. Lifton, psychohistorian.
Death has always been an enormous fear in every culture and every time, and much of cultural arrangements have to do with ways of coping with this fear.
Our cultural conceptions of reality have evolved in order to help us deal with our knowledge of our own mortality.
All around the world, we take part in activities designed to remember the dead. Remembrance is one way we deal with the brevity of life. Here one moment, gone the next, but never forgotten. With the advent of photography in the 19th century, families would often pose for photographs with the corpses of their loved ones, as if the dead were still living. Physical mementos with images of people were rare. The postmortem photograph provided families a means to remember their loved ones as they were in life.
When we look at history, at least, it seems very clear that from as long as it can be recorded, and across cultures and across vast amount of time and space, that death denial seems to be rather central to all cultural constructions.
We cannot be human without living in culture. We are meaning-hungry creatures as human beings. We require meaning, and whether we talk about it or not, we're always living within meaning, whether it has to do with family or some kind of work or country or goal. It may and usually is rather unspoken.
Culture provides meaning, first of all, by giving us a sense of where we've come from. Every culture that we're aware of does have some account of the origin of the universe.
Some people believe that in the beginning of all life, a god created heavens and the earth itself. This god then populated the earth with various creatures, but gave dominion to humankind.
The Fulani tribe in Mali believes that the earth was created out of a giant drop of milk. And I think that's quite nice. And the thought is that when God was getting things going, there had to be some sustenance for the original creatures. And so the earth started that way. And then the Yoruba in Nigeria believes that originally the earth was just water, and then at the moment of creation, God came and put a silver or some kind of metal plate on the water, and then on the plate he took a snail shell and turned it upside down and filled it with dirt, put that on the plate, and then he put a rooster on the plate next to the snail shell. And as the rooster pecked the dirt out of the shell and it hit the water, that formed the continents as we know them. And I think that's quite beautiful.
David Loy, Professor of International Studies in Bunkyo University, Japan.
Buddhism does have a creation story, like the other great religions. It's found in the Agana Sutra. They don't talk about a particular point of time when the universe began. Rather, you get both in Hinduism and Buddhism the idea that the universe has been going on for an immeasurably long period of time where world systems are created and destroyed, and you really can't trace it back to the very beginning.
While creation stories provide the members of a collective with a sense of meaning, it is roles within those cultures that give individuals a specific and personal sense of importance.
Culture helps us out by essentially giving each of us a roadmap that gives us prescriptions of acceptable action. All cultures have social roles with associated standards of valued conduct, the satisfaction of which allows you to perceive yourself as a significant individual. But it's only through a culturally constructed sense of reality that we know what it means to be a valuable or an important figure. So in American culture, if you can stuff a rubber ball through a metal hoop, you're a genius, and we can pay you many millions of dollars. But there's other cultures in which that would be considered quite worthless. It'd be better if you could throw a sharp stick through a fish's head. And so culture really gives us opportunities to feel valuable.
Many people feel connected to the eternal through their religion. From the ancient Egyptians to the modern day, the idea of an eternal soul has inspired us, provided a sense of security, and soothed our anxiety. After all, if the soul will live forever, then what need is there to fear death?
The concept of soul is an immortality ideology.
I had an interesting conversation some years ago with Paul Tillich, the great Protestant theologian. And Tillich told me that almost from the beginning, the more brilliant theologians always had a sense of the symbolic, of the idea of the eternal, rather than the literal sense of eternal life. That literal sense of eternal life was in a way given to the masses by the church as part of its way of controlling them, whereas the brilliant thinkers and outstanding theologians had a different sense, closer to what I'd call the symbolic.
Our experience of the world is embedded within symbols. We have excelled in this world because we have been able to make one thing stand for another. Language, for example, enables us to communicate, work together to achieve goals, and plan for the future. Symbols also serve as concrete manifestations of our most cherished beliefs and values. They are tangible representations of abstract ideas and meanings. Without symbols, it would be difficult to sustain our faith in ideas. When the literal world fails us, we turn to the symbolic. In the case of death, if the battle cannot be won in the physical world, then perhaps we can gain a sense of victory in the symbolic.
Along comes Darwin and the Enlightenment and science, and then you have people starting to think more seriously about the idea that maybe this is all there is. That it's just, we're just these physical materials that will decay and die. And that's it. What happens then, right? If you don't have that literal immortality thing, how do you cope?
Instead of simply trying to live on in the physical world, we take that whole dilemma and we move it to the symbolic level. We invest ourselves in symbols of that we get from our culture and from religion that come to represent us. We identify with them. We see ourselves in them. And instead of trying to live on literally, physically, we try instead to make sure that our symbols of immortality, our culture, our religion, are seen as powerful and durable, and that through their endurance, we feel that something of ourselves lives on with them.
One aspect of it is a collective sense of immortality. If you can get a sense of being part of something bigger than yourself that you feel is immortal, that you feel will transcend your individual death, then that's a symbolic kind of immortality. But also there are individual ways, and we all know this. Americans certainly know this. We're going to write the great book, or we're going to do the great documentary.
Try to figure out in what ways our culture defines the good life, and we try to excel at it. I distinguish myself, and I stand out as special. And when I do that, I've got a comparative gap between myself and other people. And in my mind, I sort of see those other people as merely mortal, and I see myself as somehow transcending the limit of mere mortality. I look around me, and everybody represents just the way human beings naturally are, but I become supernatural. So I try for heroism as a way of making myself believe I can transcend the limits of my mortality.
Our symbolic attempts to conquer death permeate every aspect of our lives. We live in a world shaped by our imagination, where brick and stone is not just brick and stone, but a symbol of achievement, of triumph, and of permanence.
The urge for immortality manifests itself as creativity. And so there comes our urge to build, our urge to make a mark in the world, our urge to show that we've been here, you know, carve our name even on a tree, just to let it be known that we're here and that we matter.
Kirby Farrell, professor of English, University of Massachusetts.
Culture as a whole is basically an inexhaustible survey of immortality symbols. The law makes you feel that culture is stable and will last forever. Architecture. We build monuments. We build religious buildings out of what historically have been the most enduring materials known to human beings. American utopianism at the moment tends to be consumer utopia. It's associated with money and the ability to command the wills of other people by paying them something, which in effect is a magnifying your own self. It's magnifying your own strength. If you can potentially make anyone in the world do your bidding because of your checkbook, then, in effect, you have everyone in the world extending your power. You have millions of hands and arms.
Wealth is a kind of symbolic barrier against death. And I think unconsciously we think, you know, if I have enough of it, it isn't going to get me. I can buy my way clear of this.
The tragic flip side of this experience is that if you don't have money, you're, in effect, surrendering your ability to choose or to control other people, or to put it another way, you're radically vulnerable. The ultimate state of being without money is to be a slave.
When you don't have $1 zillion, whose fault is it in the US of A? It's your fault, and you feel like a piece of crap. It's not surprising that a third of the American population is depressed.
If our immortality depends on the durability and endurance of our symbols and symbolic systems, what happens when those symbols fall or fail us? Once again, our symbols and our efforts to become something more than we are shown to be just as fleeting as life itself. We experience a sort of symbolic death.
sorry for pain and hurt and anger and confusion that would result from all of this.
On a social scale, the loss of jobs, relationships, and our sense of self-worth in our day-to-day lives are all experienced as a sort of social death. An overwhelming sense that we have not achieved the standards set by our culture.
In effect, to be in a state of social death is to be without money and without the ability to have an influence on other people's behavior. And in turn, to be totally vulnerable to the wills of the people around you. And therefore, from my point of view, social death is analogous to, and in many ways just as disturbing and terrifying as real death. And it's not surprising to me at all that if you look around the world again and again, you see people threatened by social death responding with the kinds of vehement emotional reactions that you would associate with a more explicit threat to life and limb, which is to say either deep depression or volatile aggression, a kind of berserk violence.
It's been alleged that Mr. Reza phoned a third party on January the 4th and said something similar to, quote, "They have taken my job, they have taken my life, I have nothing to lose, I don't have anything to lose. I'll take my guns and go to San Onofre and whack a bunch of people."
No explanation of that.
Was he employed?
Robert shot the other members of the family and then took his own life.
Death imagery tends to haunt us, and we try to constantly transcend it with affirmations of life or experiences of life imagery.
When we have meaningful kinds of connection with other people, movement, growth, development in our lives, challenges, and integrity, a feeling of belonging to some larger, more meaningful whole, that's what it takes to make us feel fully alive and vibrant and like our lives count for something.
And it can, for instance, include the producing and raising and nurturing of children, which are both a source of love and affection for us, but also a symbol of the human future and the process of larger human connectedness. And that's why after large-scale destruction, after the Holocaust or after Hiroshima, many people sought to marry and have children because they wanted to reassert life, feelings of life, images of life, and these were absolutely crucial.
In August of this year, I'm going to be having a double mastectomy done with full reconstruction the same day, which is going to amount to several hours of surgery. I'm trying to keep myself busy doing other things rather than just focus every day on the fact that, my God, in a few weeks I'm going to have my breast cut off.
Soon will come the setting of the sun for everyone. The setting of the sun.
I just can't let it take over my life. And that's why I'm having the surgery, is so that I'm saying back to the cancer, no, you can't have me yet. I'm not ready to go. I see it as a challenge. Cancer may kill me, but it's never going to kill my spirit.
Good. Are you ready for this? Okay.
Striving for immortality nurtures and maintains us. The byproducts of immortality striving can uplift us through our darkest days.
And there's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we're in a tough situation, and, you know, that helps us through, and that's fine. And a lot of great things have been done for immortality purposes. Van Gogh painted those paintings, and we, you know, if we enjoy his paintings, then we profit from that. So a lot of our immortality striving, you know, has led to a lot of great things in terms of advancing, you know, human happiness and enjoyment of life and that sort of thing.
You would think that striving for immortality would be an endlessly good thing. The more of it, the better.
But at the same time, our immortality ideologies often get us into trouble and create problems.
As the tragic history around us keeps dramatizing, the drive toward immortality is very likely to turn into a rage for survival, what I would call survival greed or survival rage.
One of the easiest ways to make yourself feel more than mortal is to stand as the conqueror of someone else. So there's this, there is a tendency to want to lift yourself up by elbowing other people down. And that can be done in socially acceptable ways, sports teams, whatever, getting the promotion at work over the other, over your colleague, but it also can manifest itself in violence.
If culture helps us deny or stave off death, then the existence of other cultures, or even differing others within our own culture, can pose a threat to our psychological and emotional stability. Tolerance is an ambitious goal given the differences we encounter every day. If ultimately there can only be one truth, then the other supposed truth must be wrong. The existence of other conceptions of reality forces us to question our own belief system, and therefore our claims to immortality.
If I believe that God created the earth in 6 days before taking a well-deserved break, and then I run into somebody like the Fulani folks in Mali who think that the earth was created out of a giant drop of milk, well, if he's right, I've got a problem. What we generally do when this happens is to engage in a host of what turn out to be rather unsavory behaviors that serve a defensive compensatory function that allows us to restore our own psychological equanimity by bolstering our faith in our particular perspective. And so the first thing that we normally do when we run into somebody different is to just dismiss them as an inferior form of life. Sure, the African dude believes that God created the earth out of a giant drop of milk, but, you know, these are ignorant savages worshiping piles of sticks and mud, and they don't have email and cable television.
And by derogating them, you sort of diffuse the threat. But they keep, you know, but they're doing okay. They're no less happy than we are. How could that be? So usually derogation's not enough. So we try to assimilate others into our worldview, because if we can sell our worldview to them and they buy it, that's a very strong validation that we are right. And so the most obvious example of this, of course, is missionary activity.
There were these African civilizations. They were doing quite fine, thank you. And we march in. We give it one of these. You're Catholic now. Let's play bingo. And in a couple of minutes, destroyed thousands of years of perfectly viable indigenous cultures.
You convert them. And if you successfully do that, and that's been successfully done many, many times, then you get even increased faith that your way is the right way and your God is the right God.
The whole Cold War was really a massive effort between two death-denying ideologies, capitalism and communism, to extend their sphere of influence throughout as much of the world as possible.
Sometimes what you can do is, if there's an alternative worldview that is implicitly suggesting that yours may not be the best or yours may not be absolutely true, you could sort of incorporate certain aspects of that alternative worldview into your own and thereby diffuse the threat. And we like to use the example of the hippie subculture that developed in America in the mid-60s. What mainstream America did was they incorporated some of the appealing aspects of the hippie subculture into the mainstream culture and cut off the really threatening aspects. One of the things the hippies did is they started wearing blue jeans. Blue jeans before the hippies came along were something that was worn by a certain population of workers in this country. But they say, you know what? Appearance is bull. We're going to wear blue jeans. And that had some appeal. So what mainstream America did is said, okay, blue jeans are going to get popular? Fine. Now we're going to have designer blue jeans. Right? And it can become a status symbol, which completely is contrary to the original message of why the hippies started wearing blue jeans. Another example is granola bars, I think is a good example. Granola bars, getting back to nature, simple foods, non-processed foods. Now when you go to store, you buy chocolate-covered granola bars with, like, you know, 500 ingredients.
These are methods of coping that originate in our subconscious. They linger beneath the surface of our actions. However, what happens when these methods fail and the threat to one's immortality is not sufficiently diminished? For one's culture to continue serving its death-denying function, the threat must be dealt with at any cost. It's a fight-or-flight reaction. The derogation, assimilation, and accommodation of others, while potentially intense, direct, and brutal, are no match for the horror which results from the fourth means of dealing with differing others: annihilation.
Who's right? Let's see who's right.
You know, my God's better than your God, and we will kick your ass to prove it.
As we look at human history, especially the last several hundred years, a major cause for world conflict are religious differences.
Ultimately, most armed conflicts are ideological in nature. Sure, there's political and economic issues. We don't want to be simple-minded about that. And yet, when you look at most of the protracted conflicts that often go over the course of centuries or thousands of years, what you find is that they invariably come down to people who deny the right of other folks to even exist. And our argument would be that that's because people are psychologically intolerant of other individuals that don't share their death-denying illusions.
A 1993 study estimated that as many as 175 million lives were deliberately extinguished during the 20th century due to politically motivated carnage. As we are beginning to see, political and social conflicts have deep psychological motivation. However, these motivations are not exclusive to world leaders, dictators, and military strategists. They reside in each of us, along with the potential for limitless violence.
I think what we see in the Middle East is an obvious example, where you have the Palestinians saying we want to push the Israelis into the ocean. You have the Israelis responding, you know, with the quaint phrase, the only good Arab is a dead Arab. And, you know, that's not the basis for any rational political discourse. You know, that's the histrionic ranting of the kind of fundamentalism that I think betrays the utterly psychological nature of these kinds of concerns.
We are Palestinians. We have our rights, and this is our country.
Enter the team of Sheldon Solomon, Tom Puzynski, and Jeff Greenberg. For the last 20 years, this trio and their colleagues have been conducting empirical laboratory experiments to substantiate the claims of Ernest Becker about the effects of death denial. They've conducted over 150 studies in support of what they call terror management theory. These groundbreaking studies display that when reminded of death, test subjects do indeed react aggressively towards those who are different and positively towards those who are similar.
In a sense, we're many gods.
In the early 1980s, when we started speaking in public about Becker's ideas, some folks were intrigued, some folks were horrified. You're an assemblage of blood and guts and organs that, should a knife impact upon your belly at an unfortunate angle, would spill out on the pavement just like you see those squashed animals on the side of the road. But what most people said is, look, we don't know what to do with these ideas. It's like poetry. It may be interesting, but there's no way that you can actually test them. And this is where our training as experimental social psychologists was actually put to good use.
Terror management theory came out of the writings of Ernest Becker. His writings answered some questions that we had been asking in our own work. We were social psychologists, and we're very focused on empirical research.
What we said is, well, okay, let's try and think about ways of taking all of these ideas and let's really boil them down into some basic statements about the nature of reality that we could then use to generate hypotheses and go out and actually test.
The first component of terror management theory states that individuals need to sustain faith in a meaningful worldview. The second component states that individuals need to feel as though they are valued, protected members, objects of significance within this worldview. Psychologists would generally call this self-esteem.
And if we can sustain these two psychological constructs, then we can function relatively securely in the world. And if these constructs are threatened, then we're going to feel anxiety and have a need to defend those constructs.
So we develop what we call the mortality salience hypothesis. And all that says is, look, if culture serves a death-denying function, then if you remind people that they're going to die, that should momentarily really increase the need for the death-denying aspects of their particular beliefs about reality. And that should be reflected by their reactions to other individuals who either bolster or support those beliefs, or who undermine those beliefs by either being hostile to them or merely different from them. The very first study that we did was with municipal court judges in Tucson, Arizona.
Judges have a kind of a clear set of values that are part of their worldview, and that is to uphold the law. And so what we thought is that if we make some judges think about their own death, they should become more punitive toward a lawbreaker. So half the judges, on a random basis, were given questionnaires that asked them about their own death. Half were not given such a questionnaire.
And then we had them actually look at an actual court case. The most common case in municipal court in Tucson is a solicitation of prostitution.
They were simply asked to recommend a bond for the prostitute. Okay. What we found is the judges who were reminded of their own death before setting bond for the alleged prostitute recommended a bond of $455. The control judges, who were not reminded of their own death, set a bond, an average bond, of $50.
In another study, Christian test subjects were asked to complete a questionnaire intended to determine how people form impressions of others. What the subjects didn't realize is that the researchers were actually making determinations about them. Embedded within some questionnaires were questions specifically formulated to make the reader think about his or her own death. The students were then asked to give their impressions of two fictitious individuals who on paper shared similar personality traits but differed in religious affiliation.
And the hypothesis was that after the Christian subjects thought about their own death, they should be especially positive in their reactions to a fellow Christian student and especially negative toward a Jewish student. And that's exactly what we found.
The students who did not receive death reminders showed no preference in their evaluations. These results were important indicators that attitudes towards others change when one is confronted with one's own death. However, the results did not speak to behavioral changes.
And so one example of a study that we've done to test this idea was a study in which we wanted to see if reminding people of their own death would make them more reluctant to use cultural symbols or icons in inappropriate ways.
For this study, subjects were asked to participate in what they were told were research experiments designed to explore both personality and creative problem solving. Once again, subjects completed personality questionnaires, some of which contained death reminders.
When they're done with that, they come out. Then we describe the two tasks for them, and their job is to try to complete the task.
The first task required subjects to sift sand from a jar also containing water and black dye. Various items were available to help complete this task.
We set it up so that the only object they could use to successfully achieve the goal of sifting the sand out was a little American flag. And so what they would have to do is secure the American flag with a rubber band on an empty jar and then pour the black dye through the American flag, which of course ruins the American flag.
For the second task, subjects were asked to hang a crucifix on the study room wall. Again, various items were available to help them do so.
In order to do that, the only object they could use to successfully hammer the nail into the wall so they could hang up the crucifix was the crucifix itself.
Those students who had received death reminders tried more alternative ways to complete their tasks. They were more apprehensive to desecrate their most cherished cultural icons and took twice as long as those who were not reminded of their death prior to the experiment. Now that the terror management team had established that changes in behavior occurred when people thought about their own death, they were prepared to conduct what was to become their most striking and ominous study. If it could be determined that thinking of death caused behavior patterns to change, could it not also be determined that these behaviors might in fact be aggressive toward other individuals?
The problem with measuring any type of aggressive behavior in a laboratory situation is the ethical concerns that it brings up. We can't exactly have people punching one another, hitting, shooting, stabbing. That's frowned on ethically. So what we did was we devised a measure where we could safely assess intent to harm another person. And we did that by using hot sauce.
You know, Becker argued, and we got into this partly because we thought this can help explain real-world prejudice and aggression against different others. But it was inspired by real incidents in which people have used hot sauce to physically attack other people. There was a case where a cook was angry at police and spiked a couple of cops' food with hot sauce. More significant and less humorous, there are numerous cases in which parents have used hot sauce to punish their children, which is a form of child abuse. But in the lab, what we thought we might be able to do is at least get some indication of an intention to hurt someone else simply because you've been reminded of your own death and they're threatening an aspect of your worldview. In this paradigm, the subjects come in and they're told that the study concerns personality and food preferences.
Subjects were once again given a set of supposed personality questionnaires. Some included the death reminder and others did not. Then, in what subjects were told was an unrelated study, they were asked to allot a variable amount of extremely hot sauce for a participant of dissimilar political background to taste and rate. Those who had received death reminders prescribed more than twice the amount of hot sauce as those who did not receive the death reminders. This has profound implications. These studies show that reminders of death play an influential role in the human psyche and can inspire us to act aggressively. While hot sauce itself might seem benign, the implications of these studies are frightening. What happens when the means of aggression is not hot sauce, but rather a gun or another weapon? And what might be the result if the issue at hand was whether or not to provide food aid to a starving country? Would we act differently if their culture posed a threat to our psychological equanimity? Many people function day to day seemingly oblivious to the effect death has upon them. Most would claim that they don't think about death at all. The industrial world has sterilized itself to the point where we hear about death, but rarely see it firsthand. But does this mean that we are immune to the effects of death?
When a lot of people hear about this theory for the first time, the initial reaction is, you know, I don't think about death all that much. And if I don't think about death all that much, how could death be playing such an important role in our lives?
How could it be affecting me in these powerful ways? Or how could it affect ongoing behavior when I almost never think about death? People do think about death and are reminded of death quite commonly. Any major city newspaper's got a murder story pretty much every day if you watch the news. If you watch television, you see stories of murder and death pretty consistently. So reminders of death are actually quite common. The other point is that we do agree that that we don't think about death all that much consciously in our daily lives.
You know, the essence of Freud's ideas about the nature of the psychological apparatus is that most psychological activity is quite unconscious.
We repress our concerns about death and our thoughts of death, but it's underneath. It's outside of consciousness. Now, how do you get at that? That sounds like, you know, this is sort of untestable. It's not untestable. Psychologists have recently developed technology to present material to people without their awareness that they're being exposed to the material. And we call this subliminal priming.
Utilizing this method, the terror management team, spearheaded by Jamie Arndt at the University of Missouri at Columbia, developed what they call the subliminal death prime.
We had folks come and stare at a computer screen and do what they call a lexical decision task. It's just words are flashed on a screen, and people are supposed to look at them and push a button if they're similar. So if you see like shoes and pants, those are similar items. And if you see like taco and sneaker, you know, those are dissimilar items. But really, that's just an excuse to get them to look at the screen. Because in between those words, very rapidly, at like 21 milliseconds, are either flashed the word death or the word field, because those words have the same number of letters and the same frequency of occurrence in the English language. And in fact, when you do that, nobody knows that it's happened. That's what makes these studies amazing. If we show people afterwards, if we say, hey, we flashed some stuff that you couldn't see, here's four words, can you tell us which one was flashed? People cannot pick out the one that they've seen reliably. So we know that it's quite, quote, unconscious, and yet they show the same hostility towards someone who is different than themselves, and the same affection towards someone who's similar when we ask them to explicitly ponder their own demise.
Many cultures have different methods for dealing with and examining death. Exploring death denial offers just one example, but it is applicable cross-culturally. These results have been replicated in tests throughout the world, implying that fear of death is most likely a universal influence, regardless of the specifics of various cultures or customs.
I think these ideas about death and symbolic immortality, about denial of death in Becker's work, extend cross-culturally. They're all primal ideas, and all primal human experiences are universal.
World events can sometimes serve as a window through which we can confirm the veracity of these ideas.
Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts.
I saw the first tower kind of smoking, and I saw the second plane maneuver around behind and hit the second tower. My first reaction, I think like a lot of people, was, "This, what is this? This can't be real." When I got past that, that this is actually happening, my first response was anger. I was angry. I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New York.
I did think of Pearl Harbor, and but I thought that we had denial of death in the sky over Manhattan.
There's no question that what's happening there is a clash of worldviews.
I think that what we've seen in response to those attacks is a lot of anxiety and a lot of anger. First of all, it reminds us of our mortality. We keep that buried day to day in the symbolic system, and this kind of brought it to the fore. The other threat is the threat to our culture. Okay, that what allows us to, you know, walk around day to day feeling okay is that we're Americans and we're part of this strong, powerful, and good nation. And that's a big part of what protects us from our mortality concerns. And now that's being threatened. Okay, by not only killing a lot of Americans, but attacking major symbols of our culture. Pentagon, World Trade Center, obviously on purpose.
The events of September 11th, 2001, reminded millions of people of their mortality in very direct ways. In the span of only a few hours, the cultural worldview collectively maintained by the United States was agonizingly damaged. The ripple effect spread throughout the world. Just like a terror management theory experiment carried out on an enormous scale, all the conditions were in place for the subjects to first reinforce their shared cultural worldview. In the United States, examples of this became quickly apparent.
Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America.
I'm just going out here to support my country, let everybody know this is one nation under God.
How long you been out here?
Since the planes crashed in the World Trade Center, Tuesday.
We show our strength, right? We buy American flags. American flags are off the racks. Also, you see Christians and religious people are turning to their religion.
As terror management theory would have predicted in a laboratory setting, what was to follow would be an aggressive reaction against a threatening other.
I think we should go over there and kick ass and take names later.
Near Tucson, we saw a man killed because he was wearing a turban. And in fact, he was from India and he was a Sikh. He had absolutely nothing to do with this. Some angry American killed him. And it's frustrating, right? Because we can't find Osama bin Laden. He's been vilified. He is the evil. He's who we want to get retribution from, but he's hard to get at. So you see the scapegoating and the overgeneralization.
that urge for revenge, that urge to be protected and call on our superior forces to, you know, go and annihilate and so forth. Those are very strong emotions, and I don't think we should discount them. But it doesn't mean that should be the basis on which we act.
We are confronting something that we don't know how to deal with. We're confronting people who use their death against us. Somebody who says, there's something more important than my life, is unstoppable.
Once we have moved that struggle for survival beyond the physical level to the symbolic level, I'm willing to give up my life, lots and lots of life, to make a heroic sacrifice to see my immortality system prevail.
Apocalyptic violence. That really means violence in the service of not just achieving a political goal. There may be political goals, but beyond any political goal is a more amorphous sense of bringing an end to the present world because it is too corrupt. And that can be justified because one is doing it in the service of a spiritually pure world.
From the Terror Management Theory research, we see why Ernest Becker's works have been called a science of evil. His ideas have given us a means by which we can scientifically examine the root causes of human aggression and violence. Becker writes that humans cause evil by wanting to triumph over evil in the quest for immortality.
Our most oppressive and violent and brutal behaviors, Becker says, are responses to our death anxiety.
The core problem from this perspective is that we've got to invest in these worldviews and then we've got to defend them. And in defending them, we often end up hurting others.
The groups of people that we have to make other, to make victims, to make not truly human, the ways we have to humiliate or brutalize them, torment them, destroy them.
Hitler was very big on that the Jews are animals and the gypsies are animals. You know, and he compared them to vermin. But we Aryans, we're not. We're the true humans, and we're going to live on in greatness. And he was unfortunately able to sell that message.
The most brutal and primitive style of coping with death is to dream that you can master it by killing or destroying other people.
It is an opportunity to confront death and to escape it while inflicting it on someone else.
Five people don't make it in this world. It can either be the victimizer or the victim, and I choose to be the victimizer.
We commit the greatest evil by trying to escape from evil, by trying to create a paradise on earth.
We are literally looking for things to label evil, so that once we've done that, we can fight them.
You know, even in the Cold War, Ronald Reagan referred to Russia as the evil empire. And in Iran, they referred to us as the great Satan.
Today, our nation saw evil.
We will not rest until this evil is driven from our world.
And I will not allow the people of this country to be intimidated by evil cowards.
We demonize folks, and we see them as the all-encompassing repositories of evil, the removal of which would make life on earth as it is in heaven.
So more people have been killed in the name of God and country than by all the serial murderers, Jeffrey Dahmer types put together. It's just a drop in the bucket compared to how much killing has gone on out of loyalty, patriotism, love for God and country.
The toll in human lives is almost too staggering to consider. Violence seems to be an inherent part of who we are. Our propensity to destroy others and the world around us begs the question, are we a viable form of life?
We are the inheritors now of a species who has made a habit of warfare.
They gave me a gun. And he said, that's the enemy over there. And if you don't shoot them, they're going to shoot you. Our unit, basically, was a search and destroy unit. Not all units have that clear-cut order. Ours was very simple. Search and destroy. I remember a sergeant telling me, well, when you get over there, you're going to be able to kill a lot of Viet Cong. Now, you got to wonder, because nobody had ever used that word, kill. No matter how gung-ho you are, it's still hard to kill that first person. I was on the ground, hiding. When he came up on us, and I stood up and shot him. The look in his eye, never forget it. And he went down. I got sick the first time.
Across economic, political, and geographic boundaries, death anxiety is a psychological common denominator. No one is immune. Cross-culturally and internationally, we see the effects and reactions that this anxiety brings. Yet the prognosis for our future is not altogether bleak. If death is unavoidable, how are we to remedy the situation in which we find ourselves? Questions are more common than the answers. Is the medical field offering any hope? Is there any possibility that we will someday eliminate death? And what would this mean for our world? Will we rid ourselves of fear if we rid ourselves of death?
Just make death go away. You know, the kind of cryogenic thing. Let's make death just disappear. This idea that you can freeze dry yourself and be reconstituted like a frozen burrito at some point, some vaguely unspecified future, I just find highly unfortunate. Not only would it not remove our anxiety about death, but it might make it even worse. If you are 10 years old and you slip and fall down a mountain, that's tragic because you're losing like 60 years of your life. But what if you expected to live for 500,000 years and you fell down a mountain? That would be even more grotesque. So you might be able to banish death, but you could never banish chance. And to the extent that stuff happens, that's just not going to work.
Are we doomed to repress our death anxiety and suffer the consequences of our death denial? Can we face death head on and at the same time avoid creating what can often be destructive illusions of immortality?
We're animals, and we're on this hunk of earth, hurtling through space. There's no meaning to life. There's no purpose. It's completely absurd and pointless. And we're just creatures crawling around, trying to have sex and eat and have shelter. And the only thing for sure is that we're going to decay and die, and just as our ancestors did and just as our progeny are going to, and that's it. Does that sound good? Doesn't sound too good.
Let's just banish illusion, and let's just see things as they are. That's also quaint, but no can do, because the very act of perception is ultimately an interpretive affair. We used to think that people perceive like cameras or Xerox machines.
Illusions are the explanations we come up with to give meaning to our own experience. It doesn't mean we're lying. It doesn't mean we've made a big mistake. We can't just look at the world and know what's going on, tell the difference between good and evil, see what is valuable and not valuable. We are creating illusions all the time. We don't just use illusions to hide the facts from us. We sometimes use them to better explore the facts.
Yes, we live in a world of illusion, constructed reality, and one in which we continually search for meaning. But these constructs can be nurturing and life-sustaining, minimizing suffering while promoting individual freedom, dignity, and hope. They don't have to be destructive. A life-sustaining illusion can soothe the empirical realities of life and death, but at the same time must provide the courage to resist oppressing or taking the lives of others to justify itself. How can we bring ourselves, wherever in the world we might be, to a place where through our actions and constructs, we practice tolerance and kindness, and possibly reach a point of acceptance or even respect, recognizing that these are not signs of weakness and despair, but rather manifestations of strength and resolution.
We need to examine the kinds of illusions that we're pursuing, the things that our culture has defined as heroic that we find meaningful.
Psychologically speaking, we don't have a set of values in place that renders it acceptable to just be a person of integrity. If you're not rich, if you're not famous, if you're not thinner than a piece of linguine and permanently young, then you've got a problem here. A good culture provides opportunities for people to feel good about themselves. But finally, that it does that without unduly harming other people, either outside or inside of the culture itself. Another thing that could be done is to think about the development of cultural constructions that have more direct and realistic confrontations with mortality. It's not unknown to human history, as you know.
People are afraid to die. We're all afraid to die. But there's two ways to go with that. One way I think we can see quite clearly in Buddhism, but we find it in all the great religions, is to do something with that fear of death, to use that, not to repress it, but to bring it to consciousness, and to use that as a way of helping us live more intensely. Usually we think of life and death as opposites. Either you're alive or you're dead. But from this point of view, you can see that they're more like the two sides of a single hand.
In Heidegger's words, we are being toward death. Or Don Juan, you say, keep death on your left shoulder. Keep reminding yourself, or the medieval monks would have even a skull on their writing desk, or in Tibet and those areas, there's skull cups that you drink out of. It's to remind you of your mortality. It's to remind you of death so that it doesn't go into the thing of unconscious denial. I think we get in trouble culturally from unconscious denial of death, not from conscious efforts to position ourselves against death. Tapis is a, you know, it was something as a kid I always wanted to be. It was a dream. It was a fantasy. It's kind of an anomaly. I wrote 14 books, and neither Harvard nor Princeton, where I both had advanced degrees, took any notice of me until I could hang upside down. It's it's many things. It's a joy. It's a discipline. I also understand, having read Becker, that there's a place where it's my defense. If not against death, it's against old age. And so this is a form of denial for me. I'll admit it, you know. I mean, I'm 70 I'm not going gentle into that good night. I'm gonna keep denying it as long as possible, you know. But I think it's a healthy enough thing.
I think there's a relationship between the amount of death anxiety or death panic, it may be for some people, and the degree of unlived life inside of them. If you have a sense that you haven't really lived, that you haven't really done what you could do in life, there's a terror of dying before you've ever really lived.
Well, the surgery was not without some complications, but I think I've recovered very well from it. Although my illness is classified as incurable, I prefer to think of myself as incurably alive. And I think the real difference between me and other people is that I no longer have the luxury to procrastinate my life away anymore. I mean, through tremendous personal growth and looking at my life, I've been able to overcome some great odds. I think I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life.
In the words of Jean-Paul Sartre, everything has been figured out except how to live. So perhaps the better question is not what are we to do with death, but what are we to do with life? Why, if we can enjoy life with a fullness like no other organism, do we often falter? Life exists in individual moments, and it is up to us to make sure that those moments are vital, interconnected, and vast. That our process of living, of contributing to the collective experience of life, is embracing, nurturing, and meaningful. To create a masterpiece out of life, a life we would willingly repeat if we had to live it again and again for all of eternity. This is what we can strive for.
Now, Marcel says that hope only begins at the point where all of our calculations fail. So when people want to say, well, we have this kind of immortality or something, that's a prediction. And I think those things get us in trouble. But I think hope is to realize that, you know, I didn't come here by my own will, and I won't leave by my own will. So whatever it is that brings me into existence, if I find existence good, I have to say, it's good. It's good. And it has to be good even in spite of my death. You know, I believe Paul Tillich had it right. Paul Tillich says you don't conquer the anxiety about dying. You meet it with courage.
Now, I can't resist following that
with another echo from an unwelcome guest's episode, which, until I checked it out, I hadn't actually noticed, was another show with material recommended to me by Dave Pierce. So, extra thanks are due. This is from episode 644, called Living Here and Now. Let's have a couple of minutes of wisdom from the author of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. This is Professor William Irvin.
We all know that friendships can come to an end. You know, sometimes friends quarrel, sometimes friends die. And so the Stoics said, you know, when you say goodbye to your friend, one of the things you should do is you should allow the thought just briefly to enter your mind that this might be the last time you see your friend. Why would anybody do that? It seems like such a negative thing to do. It's because if you do that, you'll appreciate that friend in a way you won't appreciate him if you think, as most people do, that he'll be there forever. Another thing the Stoics said you should contemplate is your own death. And again, that seems like a terribly negative thing to do, except they claim that by contemplating your own death and by thinking, by realizing fully that you won't be here forever, if you do that, you will enjoy life so much more intensely than if you imagine, as many people do, that they're going to be around forever.
You bring up in this chapter the example of two fathers, one of whom periodically reflects on his daughter's mortality. Take us through this scenario.
Yeah, this is a line from the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, who gives this advice. He said, as you're kissing your daughter goodnight at bedtime, you should pause and think to yourself that this might be the last kiss, that she might be gone by tomorrow, by the morning. And when I've had my students read that, they're all just appalled. That's a terrible thing to do with a kid. Now, you're doing it in your own mind. You're not telling the kid, you know, you might die tonight, but you're reflecting on that. The claim is, and I believe this is true because I've done it, the claim is that if you do that, you will value your daughter. If your daughter is around the next day, as she probably will be, you'll appreciate her continued existence. And compare that to the father who assumes that the kid's always going to be around. That father is unlikely to be attentive. You know, when the kid comes down for breakfast, that father might just continue reading the newspaper. That afternoon, instead of playing with the kid, the father might go golfing. Because you know what? You can always play with the kid tomorrow. The first father, though, the one that actively contemplates the loss of the daughter, is going to take advantage of opportunities to interact. It's going to be a much closer relationship.
Well, I recommended it then, and I'm going to recommend it now. I've found from my own personal experience that negative visualization technique to be very helpful. I didn't hear the podcast. I just naturally found myself doing it. It's not always in Bangladesh that we do have water coming out of pipes, and generally found myself more appreciative of these things. Let me just take a little bit of time out and say that I appreciate you, the listener, whether you submit material, which is, of course, fantastic, or even if you're just sitting as one of the download statistics, it all encourages me that what I'm doing is helpful. Unwelcome Guests is my effort to give what I can, in the language of that film, an immortality symbol. I was encouraged to see we've got 2,000 visits to the page since last episode. And, of course, all the volunteers who have been helping me with this radio adaptation, without which I would never attempt such a complex effort as to put Alan Frankovich's great film on Gladio onto the radio. So, now we continue. This is the third part of Alan Frankovich's 1992 film. And again, I shall link to the YouTube, where, if you'd rather, you can watch the original.
On May the 31st, 1972, the Carabinieri in Petiano received a phone call.
I wish to inform you that a car with bullet holes in the windscreen is parked in the road from Pusato Fermata to Savona.
Three policemen were lured to a car primed to explode. All three were to die.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra from Ordine Nuovo speaks from his jail cell.
De destra, non si poteva.
When you were on the right, you were not supposed to attack the state or its representatives. You were supposed to attack civilians, women, children, innocent people from outside the political arena. For one simple reason, to force the Italian public to turn to the state, turn to the regime and ask for greater security. This was precisely the role of the right in Italy. It placed itself at the service of the state, which created a strategy aptly called the strategy of tension. Insofar as they had to get ordinary people to accept that at any moment over a period of 30 years, from 1960 to the mid-80s, a state of emergency could be declared. So people would willingly trade part of their freedom for the security of being able to walk the streets, go on trains, or enter a bank. This is the political logic behind all the bombings. They remain unpunished because the state cannot condemn itself.
Senator Libero Gualtieri, head of the Italian parlamentary inquiry into Gladio.
The judges noted in all the cases a certain amount of interference, in some cases very heavy interference, on the part of the services of police security and the organs of the state. Instead of helping the magistrates, they were fiddling the records so that the truth wouldn't come out.
Judge Felice Casson.
The clandestine structures inside the Italian secret services first came to light in 1984 as a result of certain revelations. Vincenzo Vinciguerra, during a trial, disclosed that the structures had links to the CIA and Western secret services.
General Gerardo Serraville, commander of Gladio, 1971-74. There were bombers, in particular Vincenzo Vinciguerra, self-confessed perpetrator of the Petiano bombing, who described to Judge Casson in 1984 the structure of Gladio with such precision and in such detailed terms that it could have been the declaration of the Prime Minister Andreotti years later. Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
How did I know about these structures? I was part of the Ordine Nuovo, which is nothing other than an organization linked to the Italian secret services.
General Gerardo Serraville.
The gladiators who were enrolled received certain information, bits of information which increased over time. We didn't tell them everything directly from the start. It was all strictly on a need-to-know basis. We told them what they had to know and nothing about the NATO links. That one of the bombers, never contracted or recruited by Gladio, can describe it in such detail, makes me think that there was in fact a sort of underground system which knew about the arms deposits and the clandestine structures and which acted under cover of an official structure.
Al coperto di una struttura ufficiale.
Senator Gualtieri, head of the Italian parliamentary inquiry.
For 40 years, everything has been done to keep Gladio secret. It's a miracle that Italy, which is not known for keeping secrets, managed to keep this secret.
The Italian stay-behinds were brought to train at a secret base in Capomaraggio, in Sardinia.
Colonel Massimo Pugliese, Counterintelligence, Sardinia.
We are a few kilometers south of Alghero in Sardinia. From this hill, one can see the famous base of Bolina. This is the complex called the Center for Sabotage Training.
Ennio De Colle, Italian Gladio, 1959-1991. I was at Capomaraggio for the first time in 1959. I didn't know where. I didn't know where I was because we were transported in planes with blacked-out windows. Decimo Galau, a trainer from Capomaraggio, Gladio Base.
They arrived in a disguised plane and were transferred to a disguised coach. They were then dropped off in front of their quarters. Then the training would start.
Colonel Massimo Pugliese, Counterintelligence, Sardinia. It was under a department called the Office for Research, the R Office. Normally, they trained spies and special units. I, as an employee in the counter-espionage section, was under the command of D Office. Both the D and the R offices were under the command of SIFAR, the Italian Secret Services. Decimo Galau.
We gave them an idea of the organization. We told them that it was top secret. Their names would not be revealed, and very few would know of its existence.
Mark Wyatt, CIA Deputy Chief in Rome, 1962-64.
I never attended the stay-behind base in Sardinia at a time when training was actually going on. These were the times that I visited. It was very much VIP trips. The Italians are very much for VIP. Everything ran very smoothly. I had the greatest admiration for the men out at the base.
For a couple of hours, we showed them how to use explosives. But they never touched
them.
Our experts were the only ones who would handle these things.
General Gerardo Serravilli, commander of Gladio, 1971-74. As soon as I had taken over charge of my section, probably due to my military record, as a commander, I was used to knowing all my men. My initial aim was to meet some of these men, now called gladiators. These men, having been trained for a possible domestic intervention, though this intervention should be anticipated or at least planned for in the event of an imminent invasion so as to prohibit the so-called collaborators of the Warsaw Pact from acting behind the backs of the resistance. Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Ordine Nuovo never had its own ideology. They called themselves National Socialists, but their boss, Pino Rota, worked for the armed forces, was an SID, Italian Secret Services, expert, and recruited men for these parallel structures.
Pino Rota, head of the neo-fascist group Ordine Nuovo. Communism has changed. Instead of a frontal attack, they have put a war machine in the structures of Western governments. So all the classical anti-communist bodies have not adjusted to this reality. General Paolo Inzerelli, Commander of Gladio, 1974-1986. Some magistrates believe that the explosives that were found in one of the arms caches might have been used in the attack at Peteano. Padre Giuciano, a parish priest standing in front of his small rural church.
A Visaglia l'ho avuto un pomeriggio.
I was forewarned in the afternoon when two journalists from Il Gazzettino asked me if I knew anything about the arms deposits here at the church.
Circa qualche deposito di armi qui nella chiesa di Santa Petronilla.
They started to dig right in here and found two boxes straight away.
Così, han trovato qui due casse da questa parte.
Then the text also said at 30 centimeters from the window.
E poi il testo diceva anche a 30 centimetri dalla finestra. E quindi si sono portati qua a 30
One box was kept outside by them because it contained a phosphorus bomb.
Una cassa era particolarmente da loro temuta. La
they sent the carabinieri outside whilst two experts opened this box.
Infatti ha mandato fuori anche il maresciallo e i carabinieri.
Another had two machine guns in it.
Sono rimasti solo i due artificieri dentro quando hanno aperto questa cassa.
All the guns were new, in perfect shape.
Uno aveva i due mitra. Tutte le armi erano nuove, mai usate, quindi in perfetto stato di conservazione.
Senator Libero Gualtieri.
Abbiamo trovato documenti che dicono.
Regional commanders were told to confuse the magistrates.
Comandi periferici di imbrogliare i magistrati.
They were to say the guns came from smugglers or the Germans.
Erano armi di contrabbandieri, che erano armi di.
Knowing full well.
Insomma, dicono.
They were Gladio guns.
Di Gladio.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Dopo l'attentato di Peteano.
After the attack at Peteano, a mechanism was put in place which was used in all such cases. A mechanism of cover-up. The Carabinieri, the Ministry of the Interior, the Customs and Excise Police, the civilians and military secret services all knew the truth behind the attack. That I was responsible in all this within 20 days. So they decided for totally political reasons to cover it up.
Paolo Inzerelli, commander of Gladio, 1974-1986. Some magistrates believe that the explosives that were found in one of the arms caches might have been used in the attack at Peteano. Referring to the documents I have seen from before my time, there doesn't seem to have been an investigation or a ballistics expert sent for. I know exactly who General Serraville sent to Aresina. An officer of the Carabinieri was simply sent to report on the situation. Senator Libero Gualtieri.
From this chance discovery of the arms cache at Orsina, Serravalli and his chief Fortunato, who was head of the section dealing with foreign espionage, took the decision to dismantle all 139 arms caches. They took this decision, informing the head of the secret services, but without, it seems, telling the government or the Americans.
General Serravalli was to meet with Howard Stone, chief of the Rome CIA station.
General Gerardo Serraville, commander of Gladio, 1971-74. Stone had come over because I asked him to. When I took over command, I noticed the American financing agreed in the bilateral accords. In particular, the shipping of armaments to us had stopped. I didn't understand why, and they wouldn't give me an explanation. So I called this meeting in order to find out why they had stopped sending us the supplies. So after months of maneuvering on both diplomatic and military fronts, I could finally invite Mr. Stone and Mr. Sednawi to the base in Sardinia.
I said to them, this is our training center, etc. You could help us achieve our full potential, so why cut our aid? If this is your government's position, we will accept it, but you owe us an explanation. I realized that the CIA interests, as represented by these officials, weren't really concerned with the level we had reached in our training, but rather on the subject of internal control. That is, our level of readiness to counter street disturbances, handling nationwide strikes, and any eventual rise of the Communist Party.
E soprattutto eventuale crescita del Partito Comunista.
Senator Libero Gualtieri.
When Gladio started, especially in the 1960s, it was very active. The Americans would often bring up in the meetings, in the briefings, the need to use the structures to counter any internal uprising. But this episode soon ended, because in 1966, the CIA started to realize that it was no longer necessary to rely just on these structures, and in fact eased off the pressure in Italy, and also in Germany and Belgium.
General Gerardo Serraville, commander of Gladio, 1971-74. Mr. Stone added quite clearly that the financial support of the CIA was wholly dependent on our willingness to put into action, to program and to plan these other, shall we call them, internal measures. I said that this was not in the orders for stay-behinds, nor had it been foreseen by Gladio when the original discussions took place. General Paolo Inzerelli, commander of Gladio, 1974-1986. As for the question of how much the Carabinieri knew, and in particular the Carabinieri stationed in the northeast, where Gladio had its greatest presence, I have to say that they knew virtually everything. Arms were kept in the Carabinieri headquarters and the army barracks. The system that they used was to collect these arms with a 1,000 lira note torn in half. The collector would carry one half and the command of the barracks the other. Senator Libero Gualtieri, head of the Italian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
Una parte dei depositi erano nelle loro caserme.
Part of the arms deposits were in the barracks. Knowing how the Carabinieri work, it is inconceivable that the Central Command wouldn't be informed.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
When the Peteano attack occurred, in spite of it being an attack against the Carabinieri, where three Carabinieri died, they decided it was more convenient for them to cover it up than to act against the person responsible. The motive was, above all, political. And even today, they hide behind the excuse of national security.
Ah, national security, an immortality symbol. The people of the world, programmed from birth to exhibit loyalty to a few square inches of cloth, a particular set of dividing and conquering designs. Do we, the people of the world, do we have what it takes to overcome this divide-and-conquer program, to realize that we are all one, that none of us benefits from harm to any of us? I think we do, and time will tell. I think the people of the world are increasingly frustrated with this never-ending cycle of violence which is being dished out by the international corporate-backed deep state. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. War, Peace and Climate Change. Questions and Answers. With Professor Michael Clare. In last week's TUC Radio program, Professor Clare gave a talk in preparation of the upcoming COP21 conference in Paris in December 2015. He said,
"The 21st Conference of the Parties is being billed as a climate or an environmental conference. But I hope to demonstrate tonight that it is also a peace conference, perhaps one of the most important peace conferences in human history."
And he followed that up with a well-crafted line of arguments. He spoke at the annual dinner of the Chicago Area Peace Action on October 24, 2015. And when he had finished, a lively back and forth began that so engaged everybody that the organizers had to stop it after 45 minutes, or it might have gone way into the night. Michael Clare has written and taught on U.S. military policy, international peace and security affairs, the global arms trade, and global resource politics. Even though he's not a climate scientist, he has carefully studied the current literature and made it part of his teaching and writing. He is convinced that climate change has already led to chaos and migration, with looming conflicts over resources. For many in the audience, this may have been the first time that they received a climate warning about the immediate risk from unexpectedly fast-melting polar ice caps. Professor Clare made a very convincing case about the need to dramatically limit fossil fuel use and keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius. An audience member stood up and said, "We were worried about climate change before your talk. Now we're really scared. How is this going to play itself out at the conference?"
We have to mix the hope with the despair. So in the case of the Paris talks, there will be an agreement. I'm reasonably optimistic that it will be a pretty good outcome. To this, I have to say we should have some admiration for our president, President Obama, because he understood that this would not work unless he got China on board. You know, that's why I say this is a peace process as well as an environmental process, because we're not getting along with China on other issues. But he made it a priority to bring China into this conversation. And he got a pledge from China to come to Paris with a promise to agree to take steps to make it possible. So that gives us hope that something will occur. He's also put a lot of pressure on the number three country in this regard, which is India, because India is now soon will be the third biggest emitter of carbon dioxide and will be increasingly bad in the future. And Prime Minister Modi happens to be a real problem. He wants to build more coal plants, so President Obama has worked very hard on him. He's made some headway. So I think there's reasons to be hopeful. I'll tell you, my impression is that what will be achieved will be not enough to keep warming below 2 degrees centigrade, although it will be the best agreement ever reached before. Remember that the last time people agreed was the Kyoto Protocol. That was 20 years ago, and that excluded India and China and the developing countries. This one is all-inclusive. Everybody has to agree. So that's progress. I don't think they're going to make the 2-degree limit this time around. So the key thing to be looking at is the follow-up. Will there be a requirement that this be reviewed year after year, that the measures have to be ratcheted up as the temperature warms? If that's the case, this could prove to be a milestone in human history. That's why I say this will be the center of our work, I believe, in the years ahead.
The next question came from those with more confidence in local efforts. Can you give us a couple of examples for local or national action? In a moment, you will hear Michael Clare praise the California Cap and Trade Program. In all fairness, I want to add that many Californians prefer carbon taxes to cap and trade. Michael Clare.
Thank you for asking that, and I will accept criticism for not doing more of that. I'm trying to watch for that as best I can. But there is a lot happening, and probably it's more at local level than at national level. So California, I don't know if you're following California, is moving as if the federal government doesn't exist, so that California will abide by the 2-degree limit in terms of restricting emissions, promoting and providing incentives for green technology. And they now have, under Governor Brown, a green foreign policy. Like I say, they're acting as if the federal government doesn't exist. So they have established a cap-and-trade program with British Columbia. They're negotiating with Quebec and Ontario, as well as other states of the Union, to participate in their climate change control program. That is a very positive sign. And it's important to highlight that because the denialists, so-called, all say, and the Republican candidates all say, that the measures that President Obama favors will hurt the economy. You know, they call these a job-killing activities. But California is actually doing very well economically, even though it has the strictest emissions control in the United States. So we have to highlight that the greener you are, my state, Massachusetts, is also very high on that list, and our economy is doing very well. To highlight the fact that embracing green technology is a positive for the economy. And those states that are adhering to coal and oil are doing very badly. And those differences will increase over time. But in addition to that, wherever you look, there are towns that are adopting, local communities that are embracing, sometimes they're called transition towns, to reduce their footprint. And now colleges and universities are doing that. My college is going to become 100% solar powered in the next year. And we're growing our own food. and more colleges are doing this. So the Sierra Club magazine each September publishes a guide to the coolest colleges. So if you have children or grandchildren thinking of looking at college, get that issue instead of the U.S. News and World Report. And it ranks colleges by their commitment to green technology, to eliminating carbon. And it's now becoming a race to be on the top of that list. So those are some examples. Thank you.
The governor of the Bank of England recently gave a talk about the systemic risks of fossil fuels. Someone in the audience asked Professor Clare if he had seen the talk and wanted to comment.
He said that simply as a matter of risk, if you're a prudent banker or investor, you have to worry about risk. And the risk from climate change was growing exponentially. Hence, if you were wise, you would do everything you could to minimize your exposure to climate change, which means the countries should do everything they can to curb their fossil fuel consumption and switch to renewables. But he spoke in particular about the insurance industry, as you said, because he calculated that the insurance industry will go bust in another decade or so because of the magnitude of storm damage and fire damage and the like. And this has created a ruckus in England because he's part of the Conservative government, which is made up of people who are anti-climate action. Cameron's government is pro-fracking and anti-wind power and solar power. So it really has created quite a ruckus. And the good effect is that it is adding more momentum to the divestment movement. And more large pension funds and investment funds are taking their money out of fossil fuels. So it's having a very positive effect. I'm glad you're asking me all these questions. The more, the better.
Professor Michael Clare. Here's a question that still comes up. Does nuclear power play any role in a transition away from fossil fuels?
I've read the technical reports from the International Energy Agency, the IEA in Paris, which is the leading think tank of the industrialized nations. It's not an environmental organization. And they advocate nuclear power as an option. But they say that make the progress that we need to make, nuclear power can only provide a small fraction, a wedge, they call it, of the transition that's necessary. And it's too slow because of all the problems with nuclear power, the permitting for it, the problem with disposal of the radioactive wastes. It's expensive to get started, but it takes a very long time. It takes 10 to 15 years to just break ground and another 15 years to complete a plant. And those 30 years before a plant comes online, we have to move much more swiftly than that. So yes, it might have a wedge role in some countries, a wedge by meaning, you know, if you eliminate fossil fuels, you're going to have to replace it with stuff. So some is wind, some is solar, geothermal, wave power, and nuclear power and hydropower will all be wedges. But nuclear is not going to be a large wedge.
An audience member expressed her frustration that it is impossible to have a national conversation on climate change because the media are not responsive. And she wanted to know if the Defense Department ever gets concerned about climate change.
That's an interesting question. I mean, certainly what you say about the media is critical. And I know you try to work on the media, and this is something that has to be a multi-generational effort because I know from conversations with my students that they don't read the things that I read. They get everything off the internet. And Twitter and all of that, Facebook. So I'm sure you're trying to reach people and those media as well. And it's crucial to operate at every level to educate people. So that's one point. The Defense Department is very interesting. I spoke this year at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, and I didn't give the same speech, but I made some of the same points. And there was total agreement with everything I said, because they understand that the world that I described is the world in which the cadets are going to be on ships dealing with these crises. And they told me they believe that they're going to spend their time in humanitarian missions or policing failed states because of climate change and resource catastrophe. So they understand completely everything that I told you tonight. And they're deeply troubled by this. And I've spoken to senior military officers, and they believe that this is the world in which they're going to have to operate. And therefore, the military is ahead of every other government agency in terms of planning for this world, in terms of being able to operate. There's a good side and a bad side to everything. The good side is that they're pioneering new technologies that could be available in the civilian sector. They're building ships and planes that could fly with biofuels, algae-produced biofuels. That might someday prove very useful. You know, on the other hand, they want to develop these systems so they could fight wars in the future, even when oil is not available. So that's the story about the Defense Department. They take climate change very, very seriously, and they see a world in which U.S. allies, I name some of them, Kenya, Nigeria, are likely to be failed states, and they may be sent there, in humanitarian or police operations. Oh, by the way, this is the Navy, and most major U.S. naval bases are going to be underwater by the end of this century. So they are very aware that their whole operating system is at risk.
Why, a person in the audience wanted to know, are the human causes of climate change still being denied?
My belief is that there's no such thing as denial. There are people who, for political reasons, ideological reasons, or selfish reasons, choose to finance a professional class of denialists who profit from this activity. But I don't think that there are people anymore who are true denialists. We know, for example, in the past few weeks, investigators have, through careful search, have found out that ExxonMobil knew 20 years ago. Their scientists told them that climate change is real, that it's caused by humans, and that it's going to have these effects, and that ultimately they're going to have to stop burning fossil fuels, and they chose to suppress that information and went on saying there's no such thing as climate change. But that was profit-driven activity, not because they didn't believe. They knew. And I think that's true of all of these companies. They know. They just have selfish or political reasons for doing so. Now, some of this is ideological, because the president, who's a Democrat, who they hate and despise, is in favor of taking action on climate change. So anything that he says, they say the opposite. This is a kind of pathology. It's pathological.
The next question gave the exchange a different turn. The person mentioned the scientist and geographer Jared Diamond and his book Collapse. And he wondered if the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change ever considers the social science of climate change, not just degrees and parts per million.
Yes, In the IPCC report, the volume that I identified has a chapter on human security that addresses this question, social science. And they refer to the failed states that you refer to, the Mayans, the Anasazi of American Southwest, and others. I use that book in my class. We're in the middle of it now. And here's what I found. Maybe I should have talked more about this. Here's what I found in the book and in the social science research. Societies that work together, where people rally in the face of adversity across class lines, across race lines, across ethnic lines, that rally in the face of adversity survive. Societies that break apart, where the factions, different factions, fight with one another in the face of adversity, collapse. Human solidarity or social solidarity is the clue to survival and success. And there are contemporary examples of this. It's just interesting. There are contemporary examples of this. New Orleans collapsed. New Orleans was a failed society, as far as I'm concerned. Now, it's somewhat revived, but not the New Orleans that was there. And it failed because the society did not rally. There was no social solidarity. And that's why it's a failed state. But there are other cases, similar cases, where the people all came together in the face of adversity and survived. So that is the clue. Social solidarity in the face of adversity. And that's what we have to promote. And it has to go across all of these lines. That's why I emphasize that climate change is going to make that harder, because people who are already divided are going to be further divided. Hence, working across those lines is absolutely crucial. And there is discussion of that in the IPCC report. Very good question you raised, and it's going to make me think more about that. I'm saying that societies like the Mayans collapsed because the elites insisted on perpetuating their privileged lifestyle at the expense of the rest of the population. They went on building palaces, but through deforestation, by fighting wars for glory, even as conditions were deteriorating, rather than altering their behavior and working with the poor people and the peasants in their society to adapt to changing climate conditions. And the same thing happened to the Anasazi. So if you have societies where the elites or the ruling class or whatever you want to call them act for their own self-interest at the expense of everybody else, what that typically leads to is revolt, internal civil warfare, and collapse. The societies that succeeded, that Jared Diamond talks about, Tikopia, the New Guinea Highlands, are places where the elites collaborated with everybody else to adopt measures in which nobody was privileged and everybody shared in the hardship, but they survived. That's a sign of hope. Jared Diamond has written a book, the same Jared Diamond has written a book about what we could learn from indigenous peoples around the world. And Naomi Klein, in her book, has highlighted the leadership role that Native societies in the U.S. and Canada have played in fighting against the worst effects of climate change.
The last question in this exchange about the work of Jared Diamond came from someone who suggested that a benevolent dictator might be needed to rescue a society from collapse. Michael Clare.
Yeah, well, I've just read the Japan chapter for the umpteenth time a week ago, so it was a top-down case. This is the Tokugawa period of Japan from the 1600s to about 1850. That was a top-down rule, but it was a rule in which there was a high degree of social cohesion because everybody within that society was guaranteed the minimum requirements to have an adequate lifestyle. So you didn't have, and it prohibited elites, including the shogun, from excessive consumption. There were limits on consumption. So yes, it was dictatorial, but it was not in the interests of excessive consumption by elites. So whether that can be replicated or not, I'm not sure. But you're right, this is something that we have to think about.
That is Professor Michael Clare. The last question of the evening for him was directly from the heart and mind of Chicago area peace action. Will climate change bring about world wars among the major powers?
I've trying to think about that a lot. So that's a very good question. Will countries go to war in a world of 2050, in a climate-ravaged world? My feeling is that the risk of that is low, partly because the military forces that they would usually have at their disposal to fight wars somewhere else are all going to be repurposed for humanitarian rescue, for crisis relief, and to protect borders against masses of migrants, and to maintain order in countries that are going to face collapse and disintegration. So, you know, you're not going to have mass armies available and the money to pay for them to go to war on a large scale. That's my suspicion. Now, there are some caveats to that, but I don't know how far down the path of gloomy thinking you want me to go. I highlighted water as a crucial issue in all of this, and I do worry about wars over water. Between India and China, for example, over the headwaters of the rivers that they share is a possibility. There are other places where Egypt might go to war. They've threatened to go to war with Ethiopia, is now building a dam that would divert water from the Nile. So I do worry about wars over water, but those are what I call resource wars. But the other kind of wars, I'm not so sure. But we're guessing. You know, in the current crisis in Europe, what are they talking about? They're talking about using their navy to stop people from crossing the Mediterranean and using their troops to keep people from crossing from Turkey into Greece. That's the future. They won't have armies available for, international adventures.
And on that note, the organizer of the annual dinner of Peace Action brought the evening to a close.
I want to thank Michael. We can go on.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Professor Michael Clare. He's five college professor of peace and world security studies and a prolific author. The titles of just the last three of his books are Resource Wars, Blood and Oil, and The Race for What's Left. Michael Clare was recorded by Dale Lehman on October 24, 2015, in Chicago. Peace Action is a peace organization formed through the merger of SANE, the Committee for SANE Nuclear Policy, and the FREEZE, the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Mariah Gelardin. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The other thing that you notice is that some of the most organized communities are the ones that have community radio stations. And, you know, radio is definitely a lot more important in Honduras today than it is in North America. But I think the importance of that is not necessarily the fact that it's a radio station. I think it's that there's a place in the community where young people can go and put their energy in a positive way that puts them in contact with everybody else in the community. You saw it, it's kind of playing the role in many ways of what the church played in the civil rights movement in the United States, or that we've seen the church play in many other movements.
That's the voice of journalist and filmmaker Jesse Freestein. In this week's show, we speak to Jesse about his latest documentary, Resistance. Stay tuned. I'm very privileged to have Jesse Freestein on the line. He's a video journalist based in Montreal. For many years, he worked for the Real News Network, where he produced more than 100 investigative video pieces on economics, politics, and social movements, both in North America and Central America. His latest film and North American tour is about his movie Resistance. Welcome to the show, Jesse.
My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about what inspired this documentary and a little bit of a background about this film.
Sure. What inspired this documentary is I have a particular interest in when societies are forced to ask themselves the big questions of, like, what kind of society do I want to live in anyways? And Honduras lived that moment in 2009, starting in 2009, when the proposal was on the table to rewrite the country's constitution, which sounds like a really, like, legalistic process, but it was actually a really amazing, imaginative process where everybody in the country, or not everybody, but all the different sectors in the country, whether it be by profession or whether it be by region or whether it be by identity, started thinking about what would they put in the constitution to benefit their group or to support their rights. And people were thinking really big. And the 2009 coup d'etat in Honduras took place on June 28, 2009. That's the date that will go down in history. But a coup project is something that goes across many years. And in Honduras, they have the term golpismo. So that was the day that they were supposed to have the referendum on whether or not to rewrite the constitution. It was pretty clear it was going to pass. And on that day, instead of waking up to ballot boxes, the people of Honduras woke up to see soldiers. The first coup d'etat in Central America in 30 years. Only the second successful coup d'etat in the 21st century, with Haiti in 2004 being the other one. And that then took all these groups that had been thinking really big
about what kind of society they wanted to live in and brought them under the same roof for the first time in the history of the country. You had the formation of a movement called that ended up being called the Frente Nacional de Resistencia Popular, or the National People's Resistance Front. And they had these giant assemblies with representatives from all these groups that were going to participate in writing the Constitution then came to participate together under the same roof in how to overthrow the coup regime and get back to rewriting the Constitution. And then that movement was getting organized, and then the regime, in order to clean the coup with the help of the United States, Canada, Europe, and others, held a really obviously fraudulent election in 2009 that was just a farce. There was nobody voting, and the military was in control of everything, and it was absurd. Anyways, those elections were approved by Canada and the United States and Europe and some countries in Latin America, and but not the majority of countries in Latin America. And that was used to clean the coup and reestablish all the aid that had been cut as a response to the coup and things like this. The resistance movement at that moment was like really in a low point. And I was there covering it at the time for the Real News Network as a video journalist. And then, you know, you saw these people, even journalist friends, kind of like going into depression as they realized that this coup had been a success or would be a success. And at that moment, we got word, you know, 10 days after that farce election, that these farmers in the Aguan Valley, which is a remote region but an extremely fertile region, that has very profitable palm oil plantations belonging to some of the most powerful people in the country. We got word that, you know, 2,000 of these farmers had taken over the plantations of arguably the most powerful man in the country. And I went immediately. I ended up being the first journalist to arrive at the occupation. I stayed with them for a week, did some videos for the Real News about it, but it never felt like those videos in any way captured their story. It was such a big story, and I had always had this desire to go back and do it right in a feature-length documentary film. And then so that 2011, I decided to go back and start that project.
Now, witnessing this inhumanity and this massive violation of human rights, what did you learn in the process, and what can be learned for progressives watching the process and response of this coup?
I think there's a lot of lessons. I would say one of the ones that was particular for me, because I'd never experienced it before, was the power. I understand this happens to a certain degree at social forums. Unfortunately, I've never been able to go to either a national level or international level social forum. But there's something about having a sustained national movement that's a social movement that's bringing together everybody who's against the status quo. At least when I look at the examples historically of when that happens, that's when it happens. It's obviously also easier in a country that's, you know, the size of a medium-sized province in Canada, like maybe just a little bigger than New Brunswick. So that, you know, obviously makes it easier to logistically. But it was really amazing to see, and I don't want to make it seem like they were unified, like they were having very, very heated debates, and, you know, it got very heated at times in this process. But it was really interesting to see, for example, the farmers movement historically has been extremely patriarchal. It's very rare to see women in the leadership of farmers movement in Honduras. Now, with the coup and the formation of the National Resistance Front, now you have these farmer movements in constant contact with the feminist movement, the urban feminist movement. And so the feminists were saying, if you want to call yourself democratic, there's a representation question involved in democracy. So you need to have representation in your leadership of all the different people that are part of your movement. And so it became like a necessary thing. Like, if you want to be a part of this movement, you've got to have women in your leadership. So that is like a response that happened very quickly in a matter of a year or so, that we saw women taking leadership roles in the resistance front. And one of the people that we follow in the film, Blanca Espinosa, ends up becoming the first woman in the history of the Aguan Valley to lead a land occupation as the president of the movement. And I think that was a very clear, tangible result and very, very positive development for the future of the country. And one of those things that you don't see when you're just watching the top-level political game. The other thing that you notice is that some of the most organized communities are the ones that have community radio stations. And, you know, radio is definitely a lot more important in Honduras today than it is in North America. But I think the importance of that is not necessarily the fact that it's a radio station. I think it's that there's a place in the community where young people can go and put their energy in a positive way that puts them in contact with everybody else in the community. You saw it, it's kind of playing the role in many ways of what the church played in the civil rights movement in the United States, or that we've seen the church play in many other movements. In North America now, we really don't have that institution. We really don't have that place in the community where those young people who are willing to put in the time and energy and have the time and energy don't have kids yet, and the things that make it difficult for older folks to organize, where those people can go and meet together on a regular basis and do productive work towards making their situation better or working in solidarity with others or whatever it might be. And so, for example, at these community radio stations, you'll see how it's not just radio that happens. When the president will say something really stupid, or the coup leader, within 15 minutes, sometimes these like 17-year-olds will gather around the computer and Photoshop and will make a meme, you know, for the internet, like a photograph of the president, you know, with some clever, hilarious title on it. And you see them really, really playing a role. And then it also puts them in touch with everybody else in the community who they go around interviewing. It crosses generations. So they go around interviewing their elders and things. So I think it's a really, really wonderful, wonderful thing. And I think it's up to us to become imaginative, creative about what that institution would look like, for example, in Canada.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because I've been involved in a lot of different meetings and organizing, and one of the biggest roadblocks I think in North America is all the different groups let their egos get in the way, and we end up with a lot of conflict and trouble bringing it together. So what are some of the strategies that worked in bringing the diverse groups together?
I think one is in an acceptance that you're not going to have a movement without friction. I remember covering the 80th anniversary of a place called the Highlander Center in Tennessee. And this was a place where Rosa Parks, for example, was trained as an activist. And it's a place where Martin Luther King used to go give workshops. And it's been around for 80 years, and it's played a key role in a lot of the struggles for justice in the South of the United States. And there was a guy named Hollis Watkins, who was a famous activist in the civil rights movement, and who recently passed away. And he was talking about how this guy from Vietnam, this famous Buddhist activist from Vietnam, had come and done a tour of the United States. And Hollis asked him at the end of his tour, this is during the Vietnam War, and asked him at the end of his tour, he said, he's a very quiet man, and unfortunately I'm forgetting his name, but he's a very important person in the history of Vietnam. And they asked him, what's your impression on the movement here in the United States? And he sat for a second, and then he quietly said, I think people in the United States need to learn how to struggle with patience. And I think that applies to us as well. I mean, just when the film's called Resistencia, like in Spanish, there's a couple of reasons why it's called that. One is that that word is recognizable in all four of the major colonial languages of the Americas. It's pretty much spelled the same almost in all four. But also in Spanish and in French, it means stamina and endurance, on top of meaning resistance. And I think that's a key component of their struggle, is that they suffer each other's problems, you know, and they try to work through them. If they can't work with somebody, they find a way to not work with them, you know, but not to have it divide the movement. So they suffer each other, and I think that is something we can learn from them.
I think another part of that is a lot of people who haven't resisted or engaged in a collective struggle don't realize the possibilities for realizing their collective political power and also the gifts that are received. So can you talk about the transformative process within the individual who engages in something like this?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the best thing would be to talk about my own transformation, given my sort of involvement as somebody documenting this. I'll give you an example. When I showed up in Honduras, I was I would have considered myself an atheist. And not only would I, or an agnostic, at least, not only would I say that, I would say that I wouldn't have said this openly, but in my mind, I was thinking that I was intellectually superior to religious people. Like, you know, that they believed in some sort of supernatural thing that couldn't be proven, and I was smart enough to realize that it couldn't be proven. in the process I met in being in Central America, I met so many religious people who are doing work and sustaining a level of energy and dedication that I couldn't separate from their spirituality, and not just their spirituality, but their religious community, this community of unconditional love that they have with their neighbors. And I and so there's another person in the film, Resistencia, named Herman Castro, and Herman is an evangelical socialist, which puts him in a very small group in Central America, and he doesn't give up. And so from the time I met Herman, he lost his best friend, he lost his brother, he lost his wife, and he lost his ability to walk, all from politically motivated gunshot attacks. And I never heard his voice tremble in this whole time. I never heard it change in any way. And I could not separate his strength from his faith. And then the biggest lesson came when, after all this, from his wheelchair, and it's incredibly difficult to get around in a wheelchair in Honduras, almost impossible. And from his wheelchair, he told me, don't worry, I'm going to get back my protagonism, my leadership role. He had been the president of his co-op movement. And I told him, you know, I believe you. But in my head, I'm thinking, no way. I mean, you're in a wheelchair now. I mean, there's no way you're going to get back to where you were. And we showed an earlier version of the film in 2013 in Honduras, and that included some scenes of him preaching the Bible and things. And he got contacted after that screening. It was shown on national television in Honduras, and he got contacted by a guy who owns a radio and TV channel. And that guy offered him his own program, and then comes to his house every Sunday to film and record that program. So Herman now has a bigger voice and a bigger leadership position than he ever had from his home in his wheelchair, where he preaches that Jesus is the first comrade to a group that, you know, preaches a lot of solidarity within their church, but not necessarily at a national level. And he's trying to take them to apply those solidarity values that they have within their evangelical church community and apply it to the country as a whole, which is not, or humanity as a whole, which is not that big of an intellectual gap to cover. And so he's doing some of the most incredible work in the country, I would say, from his wheelchair. And so, well, I'm telling this whole story to prove one point, which is that I had to recognize that my scientific, logical, agnostic position of saying you're in a wheelchair now, you're not going to get back to where you were, was wrong. Herman's faith position that I will, no matter what, was right in the end of the day. And so I'm much more open to accepting all kinds of different narratives about how the world works now than I was when I started.
Which is a huge gift, because I do find people in our progressive movement are very judgmental and very unaccepting to outsiders with different opinions, and that's incredible. You're on a North American tour right now with your film. There's upcoming screenings in Portland and one in Vancouver, which Sylvia, the Latin Waves host, is emceeing. Tell us about the times and dates and how people can get hold of your film or come to a screening.
The Vancouver screening is going to be down at the Public Library Central Branch at 7 p.m. on November 16th, which I can't remember what day of the week that is.
That's okay.
I believe it's a Monday, right?
Well, that's right. Can people access your film on a website and check out one of the screenings and such?
Absolutely. I really encourage people to go check out the trailer or reviews. There's a bunch of good reviews up there too, interesting reviews, at resistenciathefilm.com. So it's R-E-S-I-S-T-E-N-C-I-A, thefilm.com. And you can also, if you can't make it out on Monday, you can also check it out online there. You can stream it for $5. Or if you speak Spanish, you can watch it in Spanish for free on the website.
That's incredible. Now, we're coming to the end of our interview. Any final thoughts for people who are struggling, resisting, and feel discouraged or alone? Any final thoughts?
There's a quote from Wendell Berry, who's a farmer and poet in Kentucky, and he says, "We don't have a right to talk about the future as if it exists, because it doesn't." And when I look at big structural things right now, I can't get any hope. It's only when I look at individuals and smaller groups of people that I can get hope. And so I encourage people to look to those stories and look to these stories of strength. And one of the things I'm so proud of this film is that I think it does that. I think it provides us with some models of individuals that if we can follow their model, we will be able to change those grand structural things.
I want to thank you for doing this, Jesse, and for all the work over the years that you've been doing, bringing these stories to light that are so important. And I can't wait to meet with you and with this process. So thank you again.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
We're going to finish the show with a song by David Rovics, We Are Everywhere. Hope to see you at one of the screenings. Bye for now.
When I say the hungry should have food, I speak for many. When I say no one should have seven homes, some don't have any. Though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways. Victories are hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority. We are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration that we are everywhere. We are everywhere. We are everywhere.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.